From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, across this wide expanse of land, and well beyond, actually, from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands in the west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Good morning down there. South into South America, a lot of listeners there, a lot of email anyway, and then north to the pole and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. I am Art Bell, and this is a new week, and there are going to be some interesting things occurring tonight. And I don't mind telling you, I'm a little bit nervous about them. It's easier if I talk about being nervous. Those of you who can see my studio cam, you know, the live cam we've got that covers me while I'm doing the show, you can probably see the beads of cold sweat pouring from my forehead. I would like to welcome WGACAM in Augusta, Georgia. They are 580 on the dial there, and I suspect heard rather regionally. So great to have you on board in Augusta, Georgia. In the second hour of the program, we will be welcoming WABC in New York. Yeah, that's right, WABC in New York. And that accounts for the beads of sweat on my forehead. I wonder, you know, in all the years I've been broadcasting, I wonder if this is, I don't think it's ever going to end. I mean, if it was going to end, it should have ended by now. I still get the cold sweats, and I get the a case of the nerves, and I get all messed up for a little while when I get on in a gigantic new market. It just happens, and I can't seem to stop it. And so it will take me a few hours to level out and sort of be myself. After a few hours, I'll forget it. You know, I'll just forget it. I'll get lost in the show doing the program, and then it's all gone. No problem. But for a few hours, in my mind's eye, I will picture the skyline of Manhattan. I will see, like from 30 or 40,000 feet, all the people like little ants running around with a million cars and millions of people that are suddenly hearing me, and I'll be freaked out. So you're going to have to put up with that for a little while. And then I'll probably return to normal, at least I always have so far. Tonight, you're in for a real treat. David Adair is here. David Adair is a real rocket scientist. And he's going to follow up a little bit, or I'm going to make him follow up a little bit, on what Gene Myers had to say last week, and that was about the space islands. Remember what a cool idea that is? I should, well, I'll tell you in a minute. Anyway, David Adair is with us tonight, and I know a lot of you will not have heard him before. So, you're in for a treat. Well, all right. As promised, let me tell you a little bit about David T. Adair. T. I wonder what the T stands for. He is a nationally and internationally recognized leader and expert in the field of space technology spin-off applications for industry and commercial use. He is a world-class presenter, keynote speaker, seminar and workshop leader, and a consultant with 17 years of experience. My. Beginning at the age of 11, David built the first of hundreds of rockets, which he designed himself and test flew. At the age of 17, he won the award for the most outstanding in the field of engineering sciences from the United States Air Force, how about that, for his construction of a 10-foot-tall missile weighing a half ton. Wow. At the age of 19, he designed and fabricated a state-of-the-art mechanical system for changing jet engine turbines. This machine set a world record turnaround time that still stands today by reducing the replacement time from 3 weeks to 4.5 hours? Upon completing his tour of duty in the Navy in 78, David began his own space industrial applications company called INTERSECT. That's I-N-T-E-R, and then the acronym S-E-C-T, whatever that is. and has conducted operations and projects with it to the present time. So he's a real rocket scientist. David, welcome to the welcome back to the program.
Thanks, all right.
Great to have you. I forget, where are you located? You're in Georgia or something.
Atlanta.
Atlanta, huh?
Right.
All right. Good. We're on WGST right there. Listen, I spent some time at your recommendation last week with Gene Myers.
Oh, yeah.
And probably one of the more exciting programs that I've ever had. Gene says that you can take the large orange, what do you call it, David?
External tank.
External tank, thank you. Use it on the shuttle, basically, and take it into space instead of letting it crash back to Earth, and put them together and literally create a tourist haven in space that would carry at any given time 300 tourists, and that the shuttles could be built at just a fraction of the current cost to take them back and forth and to help construct more of these Disneylands in space. And I spent hours talking to him about the concept, and so because of your background, first thing I want to ask you about is it really possible?
Oh, absolutely. It's an idea that's over 20 years old. First came out with Martin Marietta, the contractor that is building the external tanks. And they showed that on the technological level, it's extremely doable. That thing, that tank, is, that's a good name for it, it's built like an army tank. It is so strong. It holds a 500,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and you can imagine at 6 pounds per gallon how much weight that thing can hold, so therefore it's an extremely strong structure.
Right.
Compare that to the International Space Station, it's like comparing a Sherman tank to a Tonka toy in strength.
Well, if this is such a good idea, you know, I've had some email about it, and people will say, if it's such a good idea, then why haven't we done it?
It's so simple. It's greed and money. See, they've got right now, the aerospace companies have a cash cow money pit running in the International Space Station. They're already at, like $80 billion or $40 billion. It's a phenomenal amount. We don't even have a station yet. $40 billion into R&D, and every time they do an R&D design, they trash it and do another one. They pocket the money, and they keep doing that, and they don't have to produce anything. My God, why would they want to kill a cash cow like that? And so it's just a bureaucratic money pit that goes on in Washington, D.C., and they just that's why they're not bothered doing it, because it's just too good money right now, and nobody's raising any ruckus about it.
Well, Gene sent me a follow-up fax after we did the show, you know, and he said, boy, we've got all of a sudden interest from all kinds of very important people, and what has looked like a dream for 17 or 20 years or whatever,
mm-hmm.
now looks like it might be a reality. And, you know, he offered me, I'll be 60 years old when he anticipates he'll have it up and running.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you and Ramona have two free seats.
I think you and Ramona will be in for a real trip then. We'll give you a cabin, one on the outer ring for gravity field, and then one for the inner part, which will be total weightlessness, and you can have at it.
Have at it is right. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that. you think sex in space would be? You know, one thing I thought of after we did the show. Gene said that one advantage of being in space is that all the blood, which normally coagulates apparently, or rushes or stays toward the bottom part of your body,
right,
would go toward the top part of your body.
That's true.
Taking women who have been for years the victims of gravity.
Absolutely.
And making them into a new cup size.
Or Dolly Parton, but they'll be straight up because the gravity tug stops and then the rest of the fluid fills up in there, so it tightens them up. And
okie dokie. That part made sense to me, and I thought, boy, the women are going to love that. But you know,
the face is even better.
Yeah, where your face fills in and the wrinkles
right, the lines and wrinkles will fill up with extra blood, and what happens, it tightens skin, so it's an automatic facelift. But it's not permanent. When you come back, the gravity field will overtake it. But while you're there, I don't know, do you know of any resort place you can go to, Art, that after the first day you're there, you look 20 years younger?
No.
Physically?
No, not at all.
Well,
not at all. So, but here's what I was thinking. There might be one downside.
Okay.
And that would be we'd end up with all of these ravishing beauties looking 20 years younger.
Yeah.
In this super romantic environment. My
oh,
God, you're going around the earth every, you know, getting a sunrise and sunset or whatever every 45 minutes, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly romantic. I mean, the gal's expectations would be sky high, right?
Yeah.
But if the blood rushing from the bottom of the body toward the top of the body is good for the girls,
uh-huh.
I was thinking, you know, maybe it might not be so good for the guys.
Well, it comes back to hydraulics. You got
hydraulics?
Yes. Well, you got a heart. And the heart is a pump, and the pump will pump pressure up through the hydraulics, the blood vessels, and you'll be just fine. As a matter of fact, you'll be better than you would be here because it will have less resistance in a microgravity field. So actually, you might look a little larger than life, you might say.
Oh.
Because things swell bigger.
Okay. Well, in other words, the heart... freed from the
gravity field,
it's normally used to having to pump real hard to
absolutely
defy gravity.
Kind of
now it no longer has to defy gravity, so it's
right,
thumping away.
It's pumping real hard, and it causes the pressure to rise a little bit, which has never really been a problem for any of the astronauts because normally they're in such good health when they go. But on the serious side, there will be some drawbacks, but for people who are visiting space for short term like that, it won't be a problem for you, like calcium leaking out of your joints or your heart going into atrophy. Doesn't have the gravity field to resist it. For a short term, 1 or 2 weeks, you wouldn't even be bothered by any of that.
You know, I always thought that may be even more fun than zero-G. Zero-G would be fun, but I'm subject to being seasick.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you have the feeling of falling in zero-G.
Now what happens, your inner equilibrium gets out of kilter up there because it doesn't have the gravity field to center itself on which one's equilibrium.
But what would it be like, David, to have just a little bit of G? I mean, like a tenth or a 20th of gravity to the point where, like, you could put your finger on the floor and push, and you'd go boing into the air gently and come back down.
That'd
again
be like on the moon. That's a 1/6 gravity field. It'd be pretty good. As a matter of fact, you can increase a little bit more. Like Gene was saying earlier, we don't have to spin this wheel that fast. We could create a half G field out on the outside ring, which would take care of all the toilets and plumbing and water flow and all that such. It'd be pretty much like on Earth, but still. Let's say you weigh 100 and, or let's say you weigh 200 pounds here on Earth.
Yep.
Well, at that moment, you only weigh 100 pounds. So your muscles are designed and built for carrying and resisting 200 pounds of weight.
So it's like you're a Superman.
You have tremendous strength. You jump towards
Superman. That's exactly how Superman did what he did in the old Superman movies, right? I mean, Krypton was a real heavy place.
Very dense.
Very dense.
Like Jupiter.
So Superman then had super strength.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know that it accounts for all his other abilities, but certainly for his strength, it would be the same kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of indirectly would be same effect, but it sure would make you feel pretty strong because you could jump probably flat footed from the floor to the ceiling because the strength in your legs would be more than enough to overcome it.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
You pick up your wife romantically and carry her with some resistance. The half-gravity field could be even more pleasant for romantic encounters than a weightless environment because you need a little resistance to be able to get momentum and inertia and that kind of stuff going on.
Momentum and inertia, yeah. Interesting words to apply to sex. all right, well.
Based back from a rocket scientist.
you, as a rocket scientist, a guy who's built and launched all of these rockets, you must, more than anybody else, wonder what it would be like. Have you ever experienced zero-G?
I have in the Navy, in experimental aircraft. We would be at, we get the same thing that, what we call NASA has the Vomit Comet, which is a big aircraft that goes to 90,000 feet and then free falls for a couple of minutes. That's what you see on TV when people are floating around in a room.
So what is it like?
It's interesting, some people, you've experienced it somewhat. When you go, on a roller coaster and it drops out from under you.
Oh, yes.
You know how that everything's coming up to your...
Yeah, generally you scream.
Well, it's a little bit more, gentle on the Vomit Comet, but when you get in space, it's not quite such a sensation, but, the first few seconds, the reason you catch it so quick on a roller coaster is because you're moving at such great speeds and it drops so quickly. It's a more gradual sensation like that. And then eventually it planes out to where you, after your equilibrium catches up with it, the sensation stops and then you just feel the weightlessness. But you do run into a phenomenon out there called space sickness, which, it's interesting. It strikes randomly. There's no pattern.
Just like seasickness.
In a way, well, people who can get seasick will not get space sick. And people who never get seasick will sometimes get space sickness. It's just, there's no random reasoning for it. Really don't understand it all that well yet. But one thing that is common.
Does it have something to do with the inner ear, maybe?
Sure does.
Balance?
But one thing that is common, all who gets it, 2 days later, they all lose it, and it goes away.
Really?
Yes. You do not keep it like, you know, you can stay seasick for a week on a ship.
Oh, yeah.
That will not happen up there. You'll have seasick. If you do get space sickness, it's going to hang with you about the first day and a half, and then after that it will dissipate and it will not come back.
Huh. Well, I would love to do it. And at age 60, if I could go up, that really, really, really is something to look forward to. And so I really hope this happens.
I do too. It's the most viable way. Like I said, it's an old idea. It's not like, oh, it's brand new, 1990s. Heck no, it was designed in the 70s, late 70s.
Well, look,
idea.
Here we've got the mirror, which I call an experiment in mortal terror.
And it's pretty grim.
We've got this real expensive space station, $80 billion, headed toward $100 billion in cost already, and they're just beginning.
Yeah, you don't need it. Yeah, you don't have it. You're still on the drawing board.
And still, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think there is a gravity aspect to the International Space Station, is
no,
there?
No, there's no gravity whatsoever.
Why not?
Once again, they say that the whole idea for going out there is to have a weightless environment, which I totally agree from my aspect on space manufacturing.
Fine, but why not have both?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's very valid. They would have to build a bigger structure, and there's just no rhyme or reason for it. That's just it. Their logic flow pattern is just not there. It doesn't make sense only until you factor in the special interest groups and the greed factors and all that, and then it makes total sense why they don't do logical things.
I'm so sick of that.
I know.
You know, I mean, it comes down as a reason for why we don't do a lot of things more sensibly. Greed, special interests,
Same
politics,
old
same old crap all the time.
That's right. It's going to follow us out in space unless we change ourselves. And,
Think of it, David. Eventually, as a spacefaring race, we would export all of this.
This
greed, we would export bureaucracy, we would export bad politics and bad economics to the entire galaxy.
Look what you did to American Indian. You gave him alcohol, tobacco, and syphilis.
All right, stay right where you are, bottom of the hour, and we will be right back. David Adair, who is a real rocket scientist, is my guest this evening. Following up on the Gene Myers Show, I'm serious. At age 60, I'll have two tickets, round trip, I hope, for 2 weeks in space. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
To talk with Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM from outside the U.S., first dial your access numbers to the USA, then dial 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
It is, and here I am. Here again is David Adair, all the way from Georgia. David?
Yes.
Somebody's asking me, and I've always wondered about this too, if you were not inside the space station and you were outside, as in a spacesuit, how cold would it be? Not in the suit, but I mean in space.
It averages between 200 and 250 below zero.
Oh, man, that's really cold.
It's cold.
200 to 250 below zero.
Right.
Now, I've seen a lot of pictures. By the way, Alien 4 is coming out. You know, a lot of science fiction stuff. If you lost, do you remember in 2001, David, when our astronaut got locked out?
Right.
And he held his nose, somehow got an airlock open, and went through some space.
Right.
You know, with that kind of cold, with no air,
right,
decompressing, the whole thing. Could that be done?
Could be done, but you're going to look you're not going to be feeling and looking too well at the end of it all. Your capillaries at the top of the skin are just about going to swell and explode from the pressurization process, and the cold will actually burn you almost like fire. So it'd be, you could do it, but you look like you've been, you've had massive exposure to frostbite.
So what they showed, though, in that movie would actually be possible. I mean, it was only a very few seconds, and
right,
he held his breath.
They were good about doing that. And one other technical aspect they did for that movie is they were technically correct. A lot of explosion stuff flying everywhere, and you heard nothing.
That's right. In most modern movies, for some reason, they feel they have to put in the sound of an explosion.
It's called entertainment.
Yeah, but there would be no sound, huh?
No sound. There was sound as soon as he got to the switch and hit the door and the air started rushing in, you heard that. Because then you can have sound waves being carried by the incoming air.
So I've always wondered about that. So he could have actually, that could have been done.
That could have been done, and he was a little bit better off because he was blowing inward to a enclosed space of the ship, which he had just opened that door, so there would be some ambient heat from the hull of the ship itself.
Mm.
So he could have probably come out of there looking pretty good as fast as he did it and quickly as he got in. I think that part was technically correct, but if he was exposed for more than, and I think that whole scene lasted for him maybe 3 or 4 seconds, but if you were exposed maybe, 30 seconds or more, you're going to be in some serious trouble.
Okay. If we are ever to go to another star system, I think Alpha Centauri would probably be the closest, wouldn't it?
Well, that's debatable, but yeah, right now for the star systems, that one would be one near that is nearby.
How long, at sublight, just sublight, if we don't say that Einstein, that there's some kind of super relativity, and we can't go faster than light.
Right.
If we were to go to Alpha Centauri, how long would it take us to get there?
With our conventional engines?
Yeah.
At the speed we go now, like when we went to the moon?
Well, I would assume, and maybe I shouldn't, that even with conventional engines, we can build up, if we want to, a lot more velocity than we had going
to
the moon.
That's true. Carry more fuel and keep burning, you definitely will build up more speed.
Or even if you used some sort of slow, ion propulsion or
right.
Something that would build up velocity slow but sure.
It all would depend on which type of propulsion system you're using, velocity. You could be looking, but if you're not anywhere near light speed, which even at light speed, you're still looking at several years travel time at 186,000 miles a second. But if you're down below to where we're at or anywhere around type engines, you're talking hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years.
Right.
Okay. If it would take hundreds of years, then you would need generations.
Yes.
You would need sex and procreation in space.
If you want someone alive when you get there, at our present lifespan, you would.
Or to either communicate, try to communicate with us, or to come back eventually.
Right.
Now, do they really know yet whether, I suppose sex in space is possible, but would a fetus, a human fetus, grow normally in a zero-G environment or a partial zero-G environment? In other words, could we do it?
There's some studying thought's been given to that. Obviously, no actual experimentation has been done, at least by the American Space Program, because that's prohibited. But so
why?
Well, there's I feel that the situation you'd have to have, you'd have to have a fertile, fertilized female up there in space.
Yeah.
And it's never been, I guess, politically correct to have a mother full term in space. There's computer scenarios that have been run. I guess what governed a lot of this is that there are several possibilities. One is that the child will be normal due to the fact that we're already born into a womb, which is filled with a liquid, so we're kind of in a suspended state anyhow.
Right.
So that everything would be just pretty much normal without any difference.
Right.
Other possibility that could be really gross deformities, child could be dead, could be a moron, could be all kinds of problems. But then there was another interesting scenario that came at the other end of the table and scale, and this may have been the one why nobody wanted to deal with it, is that when the human brain is developing, it's a mass of electrical impulses and electrochemical occurrences and growing. And these organs and systems are vastly affected by a weightless environment.
Right.
There's a possibility that a child could develop to a level that you may have a problem with. You know, come back with an IQ into the thousands, maybe using 50, 60, 80% of the brain power, which might be a little of a problem for us because the child may not have some different ideas and may not interface with society that way.
Well, there's a very basic question that would have to be answered. If you, that is, if you had a child and then an adult with an IQ in the thousands, whether it would even come back.
That, or if it come back, what kind of attitude it's got. Or, you know, there's a lot of unknowns there. So,
well, the premise, and I always wondered about this, again, in 2001, in effect, you know, everybody argued about the end of that movie, but
right.
I always thought that he was himself, in effect, godlike, coming back to judge Earth. Now, a lot of people had different takes on that.
Right.
But that's kind of what happened to him, in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the people followed the technological flow pretty closely in that movie. If you watched it, of all science fiction movies, that's one been so well respected because they really got like right down to no sound when you explode in a vacuum. That was they got that idea through the scenario test I was talking about. When they saw that a child out there could develop in space, be totally different. Still look humanoid, but his brain would be totally, vastly different than ours, so he would have tremendous capabilities.
Wouldn't it force an immediate, almost immediate, certainly within a few generations, it would force a very fast evolutionary change because conditions would be so different?
Well, see, you're hitting, you'd fit right in with the policy meetings, I'm telling you. Because you're hitting right on the sore toe area.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, see, if we did something like that and a child came back like that, you're gonna rock a lot of institutions on the planet.
Oh, we'd kill it.
Yeah,
we'd kill it.
You'd shake people right down to their Baptist belt buckle.
Absolutely. There would be, we would probably nail them to a cross, or at least the modern version of that.
Well, or if we ever got the chance, they could have telekinesis power and teleportation and everything else and just simply think you away and you're gone. So that was this whole thing led to a speculation that it's an area they just didn't want to get into. So that's why, to answer your question, there was serious thought about these scenarios. And like I said, it's still unknown. No, you know, nobody can prove it right or wrong, but they just didn't want to get into that situation.
Let me ask you this, David.
Yeah.
Want an honest answer.
Okay.
If we were to launch something like that,
mm-hmm.
would there be on board a destruct system that could be activated from Earth? And would the people on board be aware of it?
That's interesting. Now, that would they be aware of it? I don't know if you knew this, but every flight we have ever flown from the Cape has a self-destructive explosives package on board.
You're kidding.
Oh, I have to. What are you going to do? Let a Challenger head, let a Challenger head toward Orlando? You know, you cannot have a space shuttle arcing back into a landmass. When it does, the override person will be the flight safety range officer of the United States Air Force at Cape Canaveral side.
You're telling me if it was coming down on a landmass toward a city,
it won't even make it over the landmass.
They would blow it up?
Absolutely. And
with people on, wait a minute, with people on board?
Sure. A standard operation. Everybody knows that.
I didn't know that.
Well, that's the way it is. All the astronauts know that. If you lose control of your craft and it starts arcing back into the landmass, you won't even make it over the beach. They'll detonate you out over the water.
What?
You'll be gone. That's part of the accepted job. I tell you what, makes you respect astronauts a lot more, doesn't it? They know this, and they accept it as part of the job risk. And it's the thing that
that's incredible.
Nobody talks about it that
That's
much.
Incredible. I never knew that.
Pretty heroic people, aren't they?
Yeah. The Challenger. They haven't... it was horrible.
Tell me about it.
And they don't talk much about it, David, but I thought I would ask. Were those astronauts alive till they hit the water?
They were alive all the way to impact. And people go, how do you know that? Interesting politics occurred. The capsule came down in Brevard County, which comes under the jurisdiction of the Brevard County coroner, who had jurisdiction over NASA. So he got to see the bodies with NASA throwing a fit. But more than that, when they found the capsule, we found the crew compartment intact. The crew was still there in the flight deck area.
Oh.
The reason we know they were alive was that, let me explain the scenario, what happened in that explosion. Let's back up just a bit. When a shuttle's built, designed, if you look at it, just forward at the end of the cargo bay, you have a massive bulkhead, a wall, which is the back of the nose section of the space shuttle.
Right.
If you would grab a toy model by the cargo bay and grab that nose and break it, it's going to break even at that wall because that's the way this thing is structurally designed.
Right.
In the very beginning, we asked for a Rolls Royce in a spacecraft, and we started off with one. We really did. But when the budget cuts came, by the time we got through with it, we almost got a Ford Pinto. Well, I bet Ford's going to hate me on that one. But the point is that we took a lot away from it. One of the things that the design engineers wanted to do was build an explosive collar that goes between the end of the cargo bay and the nose section, the cabin crew of the shuttle.
So they could separate
the
human
base.
Right.
Once you blow that entire nose section away from the rest of the shuttle, it will tumble out, and then it can stabilize itself either by aerodynamic structure of itself or use the retro rockets. But it would pop its nose section off. A drogue chute would come out, which would then eventually pull it after stabilized. Then the main chutes would come out, and an entire pressurized cabin area would land, and everybody crawls out and go, what a ride, you know.
Yeah, so why didn't we do it? Money?
Budget cuts, yeah. They cut all the budget. They started cutting back because cost overruns started because you've got a bureaucratic agency trying to make a competitive market machine, which is not going to be able to do it. And Gene Myers and his outfit showed that really well with what Boeing had to say. Boeing now is Balt Rockwell International, who's the prime contractor. They're the ones that built the orbiter, the space shuttle.
All right. Well, remember when it blew up? You remember the leak that it showed with the fire coming kind of horizontally?
Right.
Okay.
At the SRB.
Something I've wondered about in recent launches, and I watch all the launches really mm-hmm. carefully. I swear, and it just may be a trick on the eye, but I could swear I've seen exactly the same kind of fire at about the same point on a lot of launches.
It still got the same problem. It hasn't been fixed, all that necessarily. So let me tell you a little bit about that. But first, better back up and answer the question, how do we know the crew is alive?
Yeah.
See, when the thing exploded, the external tank, when it ruptured with the SRB going into it, it blew the shuttle apart, and guess what stayed in complete intact? The entire nose section forward of the cargo bay. And there's a picture that I have here with the sunlight shining off the windshield coming out of the fireball, meaning that the windshield didn't even shatter.
Wow.
So the long-range Air Force cameras took this picture. So anyhow, the thing went tumbling away from there, and so it's on free fall. Now, it's going to free fall quite a while, a good 8 to 12 minutes. They were quite a ways up. And in free fall, what are astronauts used to working in? Weightless environment.
Correct.
They're in free fall. They're in a weightless environment. These are trained professionals except for the school teacher. Everybody was a veteran astronaut there with hours in space. And what we found was OBAs were not torn off the wall. Those are oxygen breathing apparatuses. The OBAs were removed from their racks, and they had put their OBAs on so they could breathe because they had lost internal oxygen pressurization. And the next thing that we found is that the medical kits were not torn from the back of the seats. They had been removed. They were fixing each other up because the shrapnel coming through there must have been like being in a closet with a chainsaw. So these people are, you know, wounded and injured, but they're professionals, and they, and even if you have a leg or arm blown off in a weightless environment, you can move around a lot easier.
Yep.
So they're repairing each other on the way to impact.
But they knew they were going to die, of
course. Knew they were going to die. They can't talk to us. All radio communications doesn't exist. It's blown away in the impact.
Well, you know, the public, NASA, of course, wanted to hide all of this because I guess they wanted to protect the families.
No, they wanted to show how damn criminal neglect they didn't want to be found that they were.
Well, I think they have made some statements about wanting to protect the families anyway.
Well, you see what they did to the families. They harassed the families to no end.
What?
Because the families wanted to sue and all that. So they came at them like you wouldn't believe.
Well, look, I'm of two minds about this. Yes, it was horrible. They would be awake to the ground.
Right.
But then on the other hand, you know, it's not that horrible. I mean, you can get hit by a Mack truck and die instantly.
Right.
And you have no time to reflect on your life, no time
right.
to make peace with your maker and yourself. Or you can have a little time left to reflect on your life, to know you had a good life or not.
Right.
And to try and make peace and all the rest of that. And that is not such a bad thing.
Yeah, but Art, you can't control a semi-accident that comes out of happenstance and serendipity. It got you. This was totally preventable.
All right, we'll talk about that, David. We're at the top of the hour, so stand by. David Adair is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Art Bell is taking your calls in the Kingdom of Nye from east of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, at 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. That's 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now here again is Art.
Well, hello. Good morning. This is hour number two of the program, hour number one of the program for WABC AM in New York. Damn. This is, as I explained to the earlier audience, and I've explained to audiences now for years, it's going to be hard for me because I am nervous, actually terrified, panic attack, sweat coming from the brow. I have a, on my website, I have a webcam, a live webcam, and you can go there and actually see photographs of me as I'm doing the program, I don't know, like every 45 seconds or something, and you can see the sweat coming off my brow. I have little panic attacks. Anyway, I guess if all the satellites and receivers and links and so forth worked correctly, we are now on the air in New York City. Now, I grew up in the Northeast Corridor, in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia, Maryland, down near the Maryland-Pennsylvania border. In other words, all around New York. My dad worked in New York City in Manhattan for a lot of years. As a matter of fact, he once took me in and I got to shake hands with President Eisenhower, where he worked, in Manhattan. And so I know Manhattan. And there is no way, even being, and I was talking to Sean Hannity, who was kind enough to have me on WABC before all this began tonight, for about a half hour. And there's just no way for me to not be nervous, even after all these years and all these radio stations. Here we are on the radio station that I grew up with. The radio station I grew up with, WABC. 77 WABC. Cousin Brucey. You know, the whole thing when I was a kid. And it was more than a dream. It was a bigger dream than I could dream then to be on WABC, and here I am on WABC. So what I am going to try to do is to not think about it. Now that I've welcomed WABC, and I in my mind's eye, as I said, I picture inevitably, no matter what I do, I picture Manhattan, the skyline. It's like I'm 30 or 40,000 feet above it, you know, and I can see all the gazillions of people down there. This even happens to me when I go to L.A. We're on KABC in Los Angeles, and I go down to Los Angeles, and I'm at the airport because, you know, I transit in and out for something or another. And when I'm home here in Nevada doing my show from the desert in my little studio in my home, it's just like you and me. But when a new radio station comes on, like this big monster in the Big Apple, it's a mind blower, and it's going to throw me off my pace for a while, so you're just going to have to put up with that. So, if you're there, welcome, WABC in New York. A good friend of mine, through faxing anyway, Daryl writes, Art, I always try to remember that New York is mainly made up of people from everywhere else anyhow, and they're just as scared and anxious as when they were back where they came from, probably more. And anyway, when you're at the multi-million level, what's a few more? Thanks, Daryl. And I wish I could say that it avoids my cold sweats, but it doesn't. So anyway, good morning. Good morning, New York. Good morning. David Adair, David T. Adair. I want to find out what the T stands for, is a nationally and internationally recognized leader and expert in the field of space technology spin-off applications for industry and commercial use. He is a world-class presenter, keynote speaker, seminar and workshop leader, and a consultant with 17 years of experience. Beginning at the age of 11, David built the first of hundreds of rockets, which he designed and test flew. At the age of 17, get this, folks, he won the award for the most outstanding in the field of engineering sciences from the U.S. Air Force for his construction of a, get this now, a 10-foot-tall missile weighing half a ton. After graduation, he entered the U.S. Navy. At the age of 19, he designed and fabricated a state-of-the-art mechanical system for changing jet engine turbines. This machine set the world record turnaround times that still stand today by reducing the replacement time from 3 weeks to 4.5 hours. So he ought to be rich, huh? Upon completing his tour of duty in the Navy in 1978, David began his own space industrial applications company called Intersect. That's I-N-T-E-R and then S-E-C-T, and has conducted operations and projects with it to the present. Once again, here is David T. Adair. What does the T stand for?
Tyson.
Tyson?
Yes.
Really? David Tyson Adair.
Right.
All right. We were talking about the space shuttle, and you said without qualification, there is no question about it. The Challenger astronauts were unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, alive until impact.
Right. You know, one thing that I should validate is I told you that the vehicles have explosive devices on them. It happened right in front of you in Challenger.
Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. Let me tell New York about this. You're
okay.
Not gonna, you guys aren't going to believe this. Apparently, on every single shuttle mission, there is a device on board which would detonate the whole thing. In other words, if the shuttle begins coming down somewhere where it shouldn't, headed toward a city or a landmass or whatever, they can detonate the whole shuttle from the ground.
Right.
That's really true, David?
Absolutely. It happened right in front of you in Challenger. Do you remember the inverted Y? You had the big fireball where the explosion occurred.
Yeah.
Then you had the two forks, that's the solid rocket boosters, were still flying.
Yep.
Then they went boom, boom. They were detonated by the safety range officer of the United States Air Force at Cape Canaveral.
This was, however, after the crew compartment had separated.
Yeah, but if they can detonate them right then, they can detonate them at any point. So when they're strapped to the shuttle package and they want to take out the shuttle because it's heading toward Orlando, they can detonate the entire package.
I find it hard to believe that anybody could push that button.
Oh, you don't know the safety range officer, people.
Well, maybe, fine. With a rocket even carrying a $1 billion satellite.
Right.
Yeah. With astronauts, 7 on board.
It's numbers, Art. 7 people versus maybe 400,000 over in Orlando.
What would happen if the shuttle, let's say, the destruct thing didn't work and the shuttle came down on Orlando?
Well, you're looking at, let's see, for no short a distance than it would be from the Cape to Orlando, it still would be carrying 500,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Each solid rocket booster has 3.5 million pounds of solid propellant, the equivalent weight of 3.5 Statue of Liberties in each one. So, it's a total of 11. So, okay, it's 5.5 million pounds. So you have 11 million pounds of solid rocket fuel, 500,000 gallons of liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. You have the potential explosive warhead of almost a 5-megaton warhead.
Wow.
So what would happen is if that thing would plow right into downtown Orlando, let's say, worst scenario, right at traffic hour, you're going to lose probably 30,000, 40,000 people.
So there's no question about it. 7 versus 30,000 or 40,000, they would detonate it.
Or just 1,000. You know, just the most minute.
All right, here's another question for you. Remember the movie Contact? You have seen it, right?
Right.
Do you remember when, right after that guy used that cool line and said, "Wanna take a ride?"
Yeah.
Then they got to Japan, and in Japan, they handed Jodie Foster a capsule, and they said, "It's a secret, nobody knows it, but every Challenger astronaut has received one of these," and of course, it was a suicide pill.
Right. Now, that is a myth.
It is a myth.
That is a myth. No one's ever had any poison pills to take. There's a whole lot easier way to do it. Just vent a cabin, and you're gone in seconds. If you need to take yourself out quickly. No, that's just been a myth. But the explosive packages... all vehicles, manned and unmanned.
That's for real.
That's real. That's always been that way since the very first days they built Mercury.
Wow. I had no idea. All right. you began, you know, I keep reading this in your bio here. At the age of 17, you built a half-ton rocket?
Right.
A half a ton?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not heavy.
Oh, yes, rocket. It is.
Well, not in rocketry. That gets, it's pretty small compared to some other rockets like a Titan.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, we're talking about a 17-year-old kid here.
Right.
What did you do with the rocket?
I flew it. And
you launched it?
Yeah, I launched it at White Sands, New Mexico, at the testing grounds there. Might want to back up. How did we build that, right?
yeah, how'd you build that? Because, as I think I told you in the last program we did, when I was young, I really built a lot of rockets, more of which turned out to be bombs than rockets. They generally blew up. And
yeah.
I used to spend hours and hours and hours breaking Ohio blue tip matchsticks.
Oh, yeah.
You know the end of those things.
They burn too fast, Art.
Well, no, the main problem with them is that, of course, you can strike them on anything rough.
Right.
And unfortunately, as I was packing them with a ramrod type affair, and I was being gentle. I mean, I knew the possibilities.
Right.
But as I was packing them, toward the end, obviously, one of them hit the other in the wrong way, and my rocket went off in my mom's living room.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Sulfur smoke.
It was like a month. I couldn't go out for a month. I was in such big trouble. In other occasions, I blew up trees. I built more bombs than I did rockets. But I really, really, really wanted to do what you did, and you did it right, and you really did it. How'd you do it?
It actually started back, right back up and show facilities and opportunities, materials, resources, that kind of stuff. My dad worked for a man named Lee Petty, and he has a son named Richard. Richard Petty. I don't know if y'all ever heard of them.
Race car?
Yeah.
Race car, of course.
NASCAR.
Yeah, of course.
They're kind of big down here in the South.
Yeah.
So my dad was working with Petty's in the late 50s when they were racing on the sand at Daytona Beach.
I remember that.
Right. Well, my father worked for Lee Petty. Then Richard wasn't even old enough to drive then. Then they built the Charlotte Motor Speedway, and we all come to live in Randleman, North Carolina, and Salisbury, that area. So my dad was extremely good at building engines, high-performance engines, and were in the mechanics shop end of it. And by the time I was 12 years old, I was overhauling 426 Chrysler Hemis. Those, with 2 4-barrels, those things have 1,000 horsepower just about.
Big, right.
Big block V8s. So I could overhaul these things in a day from block up. So if you ever looked at a NASCAR shop, machine shop, and a NASA rocket shop, there is no difference. They have the exact same machines, the press, the rolls, the lathes, the shears. The materials that we have in the NASCAR shop are stainless steel, titanium, aircraft aluminum.
So in other words, you had all the right materials,
right.
You had all the right machines.
The fuels are even the same. Drag racers use liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, methane, nitro.
You had access to everything I didn't.
Right. Well, see, it was all there, and during the day I'd build the engine because my dad made me do it, and I hated that part. But in the evenings at night, the whole place was mine. And so those shops are built. That shop and those two shops have something in common. They build things for speed.
Yeah.
And so I had that, plus I had all the expertise around me with all the machinists, and I was a pretty fair machinist myself by the time I was 12. So I had all the materials there, and I started building rockets, big ones, fast ones.
Didn't your dad and your mom have anything to say about this as you know?
The first rocket that I built, the very first one I ever launched, I was 12 years old, and I launched it down the backyard, and it left the backyard about 3,500 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
And it burned a hole in the yard back there about half the size of the football field. Burnt the grass to the roots, and that thing was screaming to the sky. My mother come running out the backyard, and I had some friends standing there with me, and I turned around, they were gone. We weren't even allowed to play with matches at that age. And here, this thing done blow the fireball the size of a football field, and it, my mother seeing this thing just rocking off. I got an altitude reading on it. Now people ask, well, how you got the equipment for an altitude reading?
Yeah, how?
It's so simple, Art. You grab a piece of little plywood,
yeah,
and you take a protractor, you know, that little plastic half moon thing?
Sure.
You glue it on the board, punch a hole through the center of it, put a 36-inch long piece of wood strip on it, screw two little eyelets on each end like gun sights,
yeah,
mark 500 feet from the pad to where you're standing so you get the cosine tangent of 1 on the table trigonometry, and you take a stopwatch and you lift the eyelets and you track the rocket till it gets to its high point on apogee. Turn around, look at the protractor, take your degrees, put it back on the trigonometry table, and there's your altitude. With your stopwatch, you got velocity.
So how high did it go?
Not bad. I made about 12,000 feet.
12,000 feet?
Yeah, it was pretty good ways. And clear blue sky that day.
Now, suppose there had been the equivalent of a Flight 800 going over.
Well, I guess I had enough foresight because I lived in, at that time, I called the airport, and I knew that the flight schedules and timetables where everybody was in that particular area I was at, and I'd plot out their little flight paths and what times they fly, and there are standard route patterns. You know, they're off a few minutes, but you got windows that you can shoot through. And FAA every once in a while would come out there and know what they were looking for. These strange-looking blips on their radar, but...
So you call a control tower, and here you are a kid.
No, I actually call FFS, Flight Service Station. They'll give you times and schedules.
But, I mean, even so.
Right.
Hey, kid, you're going to do what?
No, you don't tell them what you're doing.
Oh, I see. In other words, you just
want to know what are the routes and what vectors they fly and when they fly and their time quarters. And that's free information. They'll give it to you.
Well, sure.
And so I just plot it out on the map, take out the compass and put it on the, you know, the two little legged compass thing, not the magnetic compass, but the architectural drawing compass. Put it on the map and you plot, get your plots on your map where you're at. You can tell exactly where everybody is at one time. And you just time yourself and shoot and it comes back down. It only takes a couple minutes to get it up and get it back down.
Well, actually, I would think 12,000 feet would be more than a couple of minutes.
Well, not really, because, see, after you shoot it out there, the parachute's not going to come out for it. You're going to have the delay charge. So it's a ballistic coming back, you know, and the free-falling formula object, that thing's moving over 180 miles an hour back. Actually, it picks up even faster speed than that, being ballistic. No, it gets back quick, but then you use your delay charge, count out your seconds, and what's your formula for free-falling objects.
Well, now, there's another problem. What did it come down on?
Well, I was in a big cow field, huge cow field, miles of it. There was four farms that intersected with each other, and the four farmers let me get right. In the four corners where all the four farms met, I was allowed to get right at that center point, and so I had private farms in 360 degrees in all directions for miles. And I was really lucky as farmers let me do that. And they had tucked a backhoe and dug out a big dirt pit with a dirt ramp. And I could do silo launching because not everything was successful. But
so you did have some failures.
Oh, man. Did
oh,
I
I'm
ever.
So glad to hear that.
Oh, God, Art. Yeah, well, I tell you, well, your failures were modest, I would have to say, because, boy, mine, when they messed up, it was horrible. That's why I did silo launching, so if they explode, I don't sling shrapnel in all directions and hurting cows that always were nearby.
Well, my silo launch, the one I did, it blew up the silo and a giant limb off a tree in my backyard. And actually, that was the end of my home rocketry career, and pretty much my rocketry career anyway.
I'll tell you about a mishap when we come back.
All right. David Adair is my guest, and just wait till you see where we're going with this. Eventually to an area adjacent to me right now. I'm out here in the desert near Area 51, otherwise known as Dreamland. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, and we will be right back.
Talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies. Dial 1-800-825-5033. That's 1-800-825-5033. Now, here again is Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. Good morning. David T. for Tyson Nadir is my guest. He's actually a rocket scientist, and the story I am going to have him tell here in a moment is one that, if you didn't understand his credentials, would stretch your credulity. It concerns an area that I'm adjacent to here out in the middle of the desert. A strange universe once said about me, my neighbors here are lizards and scorpions and stuff like that. That's the kind of area we're in, near dreamland. We'll tell you about that. Well, all right, back now to David Tyson Adair. David, you were going to thrill me with one of your great failures.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. What happened was, while I was out in this this huge farm area with these cow fields, these cows would come up, and while I'd be working in the bottom of this big dugout area, the cows would all line up and look down in the hole at me, and it's like working in a surgery room with all these doctors looking over at you. So they see me. They were smart too, because if I'd walk out of there, they'd all turn around and walk back a good ways, knowing that something's going to fly out of there.
Something bad is going to happen, yeah.
Right. If I run out of there, they all turn and run. So they knew whether walk or run, depending on what's going on. So they got used to me, and they got used to rockets roaring out of there, and they did make a lot of noise. But this one day, I was having a really difficult time. This was a two-stage liquid-fuel rocket. And anytime you start dealing with multi-stage and cryogenic rocket engines, it is a difficult and complex thing to do.
Mm.
So I've got a two-stage rocket, and the first stage ignited, and it's coming out of the silo just fine. It gets up even with the event horizon, the opening of the
event horizon, yes.
And then the second stage ignites, blowing the first stage back down to the pit, which explodes. All this within fractions of a second. The fireball bounces off the floor, comes back up, hits the second stage, and turns it on its side, completely horizontal with the ground. Now this rocket is skipping across the ground, heading toward this big herd of cattle. And I'm standing there going, oh, I kind of like these cows, you know. And I thought, oh, God, this quickest prayer ever made, please help me, you know. And this thing did about two skips and then jumped and nosed into the ground about 100 yards away from the herd. Well, the engine is wide open, and it's just vibrations too much, an internal failure, and it explodes. Blows a fireball about the size of a school bus, roars up in front of these cows, and I can see the cows' faces. They got eyes as big as saucers. They're not used to this. And
no.
They all make a turn, just like an army, a total unison about face. And they stampede. Now, that's okay. The problem is, on the far side, I can see over on the far side of the herd, there's this one poor cow. She's looking in another direction, didn't see anything. And she disappears. And I run over there, and this cow has been trampled to death. It was dead. It was all, she was all busted up. And I'm standing there going, I'm trying to pick its head up. And I'm going, oh, God, you know, I'm killing this cow. So the farmers come running out there, and they get there with their pickup trucks, and they go, you all right? And I said, yeah. And I said, I don't think this cow is, though. And they're going, no, cow looks pretty dead. So they go back and get the front end loader and come by and scoop this cow up. And they said, you got to come back to the barn. And I thought, oh, God, I'm going to be thrown off this property. They're going to be the neatest launch site I've ever had. So we get back here, and they put a chain on this cow and hoist this cow up on a chain by a tree. And they said, normally we take cows to the slaughterhouse, but it's really hot today and we don't have time. And they said, you're going to have to dress this cow. And I'm standing there, and I'm only 13 years old, and I'm going, why would I want to put a dress on this cow? And they all start laughing but trying to be quiet. And then I hear behind me this, and they give me a chainsaw thing. And I'm going, oh, my God.
Oh, no.
And I had to, I was up in that cow to my shoulders. And I turned every color of the rainbow. I'd lost groceries a couple of times. And I got skinned this thing. I cut it. They didn't do anything except watch and chew their tobacco. And I got this thing cut up in all kinds of sections. And
just one thing I'm curious about.
Yeah.
Did the cows come back and look at you after all this?
Actually, they did. They're a forgiving animal, and they get used to routines, and they just that was a little bit much for them. But everything settled down, and my dad showed up while I was just finished the cow, and they told him what happened, and my dad was going to pay for the cow, and they said no. And as a matter of fact, they gave us half the cow for the winter.
Really?
So they had such a great time watching me turn colors. So I was really blessed with having some really supportive people in the area at that time. But,
well, I guess you were nurtured properly.
Yeah,
right.
I had good people around me. And so anyhow, and the farmer's wife made a hat for it. It was a baseball cap, and they stitched this name in it, really neat name. It was Speed. And it's not S-P-E-E-D, it's S-T-E-P-D, which is short for Stampede. So my nickname stuck like glue. My name was
Stampede.
Speed from there on.
I see. All right. Well, then it wasn't that much longer until I want you to tell the Area 51 story.
Okay.
I really want you to tell that story again.
Right.
I listened the first time and I went, oh, come on, this can't be true.
Right.
But it is true, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why we're validating it by backing up here, showing you how this just, it was a natural progression. See, by launching all these rockets and building all this stuff, it wasn't long before I was in newspapers all the time. Since I was in the newspapers so much, you attract other attention.
Prodigy kid.
Yeah, well, that's what they called me, and I don't know about that. I think I'm more like Forrest Gump, just in the right place at the right time. But what happened was my congressman of the area, at this time we had moved from North Carolina to Ohio. So from sixth grade to graduation in high school, I was living in Mount Vernon, Ohio.
Right.
So at this time, the local congressman saw me, how much I was in the newspapers, I was winning lots of science awards and such. And he was running for election, re-election. He was about to lose. He was losing in the polls some. So he comes over and he grants me. He asks me if I wanted to go to some political picnics and parties. And I said, sure. So we go over there and we show up. And while he's standing there, and these people show up and runs over and puts his arm around me, gets his picture taken. And I read the newspaper all these wonderful things he's done for me. And I'm going, you know, this guy ain't done anything for me. So the congressman... name's John Ashbrook, and so I got Congressman Ashbrook off to the side, and I said, look, here, I need this, and I gave him a list about as long as your leg, and he goes, what is all this? Is this a list of materials I need and special help with this new type engine I want to build? And he goes, I can't help you, that looks like hundreds of thousands of dollars. I said, yeah, it's more than that, actually. But I said, yeah, you're going to help me. And he goes, why? I said, because if you don't, I'm going to walk over there to the press and tell them you've been dragging me around like a puppet on a string. You haven't done squat for me, and you won't be elected to a dog catcher.
You really said that?
I certainly did, because I was serious about this. And he said, after seeing my face, he said, you're serious? I went, yeah, I'm serious.
Let me see the list again, son.
Yeah, well, he said, this is blackmail. I said, I know. I learned it from your colleagues. So, anyway...
you're lucky to be alive. You're lucky to be alive, actually.
Well, that's where the whole thing started getting interesting, because at first he was a little upset. Then he really got pretty congenial about things, and later on I found out why, because who he had talked to. So the money came through, and his office handled the appropriations, and off we went. So
you had a bunch of money, huh?
It was a bunch. And then I had to have special materials. Now, I had pretty much everything I need on conventional things, but this engine was totally different.
What were you going to build?
This is an electromagnetic fusion containment engine. Now,
An electromagnetic fusion containment engine.
Right.
Now, first of all, as far as I knew, we have not yet achieved fusion. Now, I understand that...
What, at that time?
Yeah.
It's been around for a while. In 1973, AAAS, the American Association for Advancement of Science, wrote a book called The Future in Energy, and they talked all about electromagnetic fusion containment in the Soviet reactors, the Breeder Tomka reactors.
Okay, the way you contain a fusion reaction is with electromagnetism. Is that correct?
That's correct.
you, in other words, you form a field around it, that's the only thing that keeps it where it is.
Right.
And if it gets out of where it is, that's bad.
Yeah, it's real bad. It gets kind of warm.
All right, so you suddenly had all these materials, and mm-hmm. you started building this thing.
Right.
And you were how old?
Let's see, at this time, 13, almost 14.
Almost?
When I was right around 13, let's see, 17, about 13 years old when I started.
How long did you work on this?
I worked on it for about 4 years, up until I was 17 years old.
And it was did you have help?
I had a lot of help. There was, not only did I have the financial help, I also had this big state-of-the-art machine shop. I had other machinists around me, but then with the funding, I could hire other machine shops, subcontract stuff off-the-shelf equipment and materials, which was everywhere at that time that we could use. So it was a collective effort, but it got even more crowded, I guess, because the congressman brought in a person who functioned like a project manager, and this was a retired Air Force general at the time named Curtis LeMay.
Oh. He was the big guy when I was in the Air Force.
Right. So he came. He was retired. And if you look in the back of his autobiography book called Iron Eagle, and flip to the back of it, you will see that his parents were residing in a convalescent care facility in Mount Vernon, Ohio.
Right.
At the same exact time years I was building this rocket. And that's a direct tie-in because my mother was an LPN, licensed practical nurse. She was the personal caregiver to LeMay's parents.
Oh.
So with that going on, and he had learned about me, and then the congressman knew about LeMay's parents being his district. He knew LeMay. He asked LeMay if he'd be interested in helping out with this thing, and since he had listened to my mother for a couple years on me, he agreed to, and that's how this whole thing happened. It just, you know, circumstance come together. So LeMay was quite helpful because of his former position of being a SAC commander and a Joint Chief of Staff, and he was quite helpful in obtaining fuels and things that we needed, which wasn't easy to get. So what happened, though, when he entered the project, there was a whole shift of change. The Air Force showed up in force, and I was allowed to work on it and do everything I needed, and they were very helpful. Everybody was extremely helpful. All kinds of materials and support and aid was coming, and everything from personnel to supplies to everything. So the reason why, they wanted to see if this thing would work.
Of course.
And being a child at the time, they just thought I was so naive. I didn't know what was happening, but I could tell this thing suddenly became government-owned. So I became, at that age, a government project.
So you, yes, so they were watching you, I suppose.
Every day.
Every day?
Every day. There was somebody there, because I'd go to school.
Uniform type guys or black suit guys or what?
Both. Sometimes it was civilian clothes, sometimes uniform. Sometimes they alternate, be the same person wearing either a suit or a uniform, depending on, I guess, whatever their status was for the day. But they'd come and go, and they just... They really were very helpful, and they just were assisting. And I got to really do all my work, so it didn't bother me.
How big was this thing?
It's 10 feet tall.
10 feet tall.
Right. And that's the height from the floor to a basketball goal hoop.
So yeah, that'd be about right, I guess.
That's 10 foot. So it was in my shop, and I was allowed to work on it all the time. So it became – the only thing we had to do, though, or I had to agree to, was we had to stop letting the press in to photograph. Although I did get some neat, I was on the front page of Mount Vernon News, standing alongside of it.
I take it you've got photographs of it.
Oh yeah, there's all kinds of newspaper stories on it. I've got a lot of people have seen them.
But the technology that you were developing, specifically with the drive, the engine.
It was a little bit different, and but you know, it's not like I invented this. Far from it. There are 60 engines cataloged in NASA right now in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Marshall Space Flight Center in the Advanced Research Program that can get you off this planet. They have had these things cataloged for decades and decades. The two engines that you're familiar with is a solid rocket propellant and a liquid fuel.
That's correct.
Wannon von Braun was an extremely good salesman in that area, and that's what we bought into. We've been there ever since. But there are 57 other engines, and I just picked one of the other 57 not to build. That's all. It's just that simple. You know, no big deal. And so I just decided, I thought that the one that I could do was the electromagnetic fusion. Now, the problem is containing the field, and that's where I did run into problems. I ran into mathematical problems because you have to build a mathematical algorithm models to perpetuate these fields, and it got difficult because, see, this is 1968, 67, 69, and there are no laptop computers,
right.
No CD-ROMs, no hard drive, no faxes, no modems, no cellular phones, no pages, no beepers, none of this stuff. All I got to work with is pencil, paper, and chalkboards and a thing called a slide ruler. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
And that is all I have. I didn't get a handheld calculator until 10 years later with Texas Instruments. So, you know, it's tough, y'all. I'm having to do a lot of math here in my head. And finally, I just come to the end of my rope. I couldn't get this thing to close. The best I finally came up with some other people's help, we came up with about 5 seconds. We could sustain the thing for 5 seconds on a tutorial compressor cone design.
You could do what now? You could
sustain the field.
Sustain the field for 5 whole seconds.
5 whole seconds. That doesn't sound like long, but let me tell you, as you well know, in rocket flights, that's a lifetime.
Yep.
That's plenty. I went, oh, I can live with that. That's plenty of time. So we're going to get a burst. And what that police will tell us a lot right there by the burst of energy.
Burst.
So it all came together, and we got the thing built. And then, obviously, you can't launch something like this in a civilian area.
Oh, no.
So they sent me to, we put the thing on a track and trailer, a low boy. And my dad drove the thing down to, he and I drove it down to Wright Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio.
Right, Pat.
Yeah, because that's, it's right there. We were in Mount Vernon, Ohio, right, you know, Dayton, Ohio, just a little ways from us.
Right.
So we went down there, and that's where LeMay set everything up for us. And as soon as it got there, then they realized that it's time to go on to somewhere else called White Sands. So they put the rocket and myself on a C-141 Starlifter, and off we went.
So they took you to White Sands
right.
In a C-141.
Right. So we get there, and then we offload, and the colonel that was assigned to me.
Were you scared?
No, I never was. In the end, the only thing I was not scared about, but the only thing I was worried about was I hope the engine worked.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't had any way of really doing this. All other engines, I could do static tests. That's where we strap the thing down in a test cell and turn on the engine until it burns all the way through, and you know, you get a lot of information that way. But
this one was theoretical until the first trial.
Right. And I hadn't had, so I didn't know what was going to happen. I had some theories, but anyway, it was a little bit more than I was expecting. But we got the thing built, and like I said, we got down there, and then the colonel was real helpful. He was a nice man, and he told me that I'm probably in trouble, and I'm going, why? I hadn't done anything with anybody. He said, it doesn't matter. He said, if your engine works, son, you're in trouble.
Why?
Well, that's what I asked. I said, how come? He said, well, they're gonna want to, he said, this is going to ask things and get real involved in your life, and it's going to be a problem for you. That's all he would say. And I was sitting there going, what is this about? So he said, particularly if a black plane shows up, it will be a real problem for you. It will be called DOD. And I went, what is DOD? You know, he goes, Department of Defense. Well, we were there for a couple hours, and this black DC-9 comes in. And I asked, wow, where's the white bunny head? nobody hardly got that joke. Remember back in that time, Hugh Hefner, Playboy, would fly his black DC-9?
Yes, I do. I do.
So I made a comment like that, and I just, nobody appreciated the humor, so. Anyway, off come these guys, sure enough, in civilian suits.
These are serious guys.
Yeah, they are, wearing mirror sunglasses, like the colonel would say. They'd be in dark suits, mirror sunglasses. Sure enough, they were. Except for one guy, the older guy, got off in dressed in kind of like a khaki outfit, looked like Marlon Perkins. And I recognized him from the very beginning because Wannon von Braun had told me some interesting stories about Peanut Monday and how everything went on over there, and how Operation Paperclip brought them all in.
So who was he?
His name was Dr. Arthur Rudolph. And Arthur Rudolph was, well, he's a sweet guy. he was a chief architect of the Saturn V engines.
Oh, yes.
He also, let me look at this newspaper story right here. On May, I'm going to get these two backwards. May 24th, 1984. No, May 25th, 1984. Dr. Arthur Rudolph was deported back to Munich, Germany, where he died in prison. He was sent there by the authorities because he was a Gestapo Nazi and had killed hundreds of thousands of Czechoslovakian Jews at Metalworks in Peenemünde when they were building the V-2s.
But there he was getting off a black airplane. All right, we will pick up on the story after the top of the hour news. David T. for Tyson Adair is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Talk with Art Bell from west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. Dial 1-800-618-8255. That's 1-800-618-8255. Now again, here's Art.
Well, once again, here I am. My guest is a rocket scientist, David Adair, and we're right in the middle of his story, his Area 51 story. We'll get back to him in a moment. All right, back now to David Adair, who built a rocket as a youngster and then actually built a fusion rocket, a fusion-powered rocket that a congressman came up with money for him to build, you know, get the parts and do the work. And then he made a connection in the Air Force with General LeMay, and he took this rocket and they transported him from Wright Pat down to White Sands, where he's unloading the rocket, and here comes this black airplane, which lands, and that's kind of where we are right now. I just got a fax from Stan in Los Angeles who says, Art, in 1980, ABC World News announced that TRW was awarded a contract way back then to build a fusion engine. I had no idea. Anyway, so here we are at White Sands, and here comes this German fellow getting off the plane, this black, unmarked, no doubt, plane, who was, again, who was he?
Dr. Arthur Rudolph.
Dr. Arthur Rudolph.
Right.
A rocket scientist, I guess?
Oh, very much so. He was brilliant, but he was equally mean as he was brilliant. Because, like I said, he had killed so many people in Peenemünde. He would feed the Czechoslovakian workers sawdust and water. The water expands sawdust. He'd work you till you die, and then he'd get somebody else. And that's how they built the V-2 rockets in Peenemünde. If you make one mistake, he'd hang you from a rafter.
Uh-huh.
So, sweet guy you're dealing with.
Great.
He also, when he was deported back to Munich, he took the most distinguished service award of NASA, the highest award that they give. They didn't want to tell you this story, did they?
No.
So anyway, he was there, and he got over. He came over, and he looked at me, and said, "I asked him who he was, and he gave me a different name, like Henry something." I thought, "Boy, gee, this guy's got a German accent, blue eyes, you know, and he's got a name Henry." Oh well. So I knew who he was because I'd seen a picture of him that Von Braun had showed me. So he wanted to look at the engine and the rocket. I said, "Sure, go ahead." So
right.
He looked in there and kind of got him a little upset. But I leaned over his head and told him, in proportional size, if everything works right, this has about 10,000 times the power of your F1 Saturn V engines, Dr. Rudolph. Oh, that he jumped up. He got real upset about that. and asked me who I was, and I said, just a kid that flies rockets in a cow field.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, we got the thing set up, and it launched. And but before we launched, he made me set coordinates on this thing, which would take it, bring it down. Now, see, we could have went straight up and straight down and come right back into testing.
Which is what your normal modus operandi was,
right,
to have it come back down to you.
Sure. Why do you want to go miles somewhere when you drop it right back down and maybe walk, you know, half mile and go pick it up?
So he gave you other coordinates.
Yeah, he was so adamant about it. And they made double sure that that thing was exactly fed into the off-the-shelf telemetry we had for it. So we did, and he dropped it 456 miles northwest of us, which is about 120 miles north of Las Vegas.
Now, we'll get to that. What happened when this thing lifted off?
It left rather quickly. actually, it left much faster than anticipated. There's only two speeds on these engines, really. They're not like a conventional rocket engine where you have liquid fuel, solid propellant, or whatever, which is slow-burning oxidants, and they burn off. They start, and then they build up speed, and so they take off rather slow but build up tremendous speeds and rather quickly. This thing is just like a slingshot effect. It's like off and wide open. And
you mean just literally, and
it
exploded. Gone?
It, in other words, we never saw it leave. It's like
you never saw it leave.
Right. It left this vortice, this white tornado where it was. Have you ever tried to see a bullet leave a rifle barrel? That's what it's like trying to see it.
No, of course you don't.
No, so it's just tremendous acceleration speed. And the reason why these engines really aren't designed for in-Earth orbit launching or surface launching, they're really designed for orbital launches so that you're not affected by the gravitational field so much because they have such tremendous acceleration power.
All right, well, so this thing took off.
It ripped out of there.
Or more accurately, just about disappeared, and you... you must have been left with your mouth hanging open and ask them, well?
Yeah, I was sitting there, and at first everyone thought it exploded because also the thing is that the exhaust on it is not like your standard orange or blue flames. They're, it's like a welder's arc. It's bright as the sun. So this, imagine a streak of lightning just gone into space. That's what we saw, like a streak of lightning.
Wow.
And they kind of assumed it just exploded. It was just fragments burning upward. But then a few minutes later, the red phone rings, and it's NORAD, and they want to know what's going on because they said a rocket blew up down here. I said, no, I don't think so. They said that we've got it at, we're tracking it. And they said, do you know where it's going? They said, yeah, if it's on course. And they said, it's on course. So it's going exactly where it's supposed to be going. So we get out there and we get on board the DC-9 and
may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Was this on a ballistic trajectory or was there any guidance? Was there specific guidance?
Oh, there's specific guidance. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
There was a telemetry guidance system. Also, soft impact had parachutes.
Okay.
So it wasn't just coming in and smashing in.
Oh, I see. All right. Okay.
So it had delayed reaction. It was going to get within proximity of the ground, even with wind drifts in the desert. It would land well within the target area they wanted it, so it would stay within the property area. And the only name I ever knew this place by was called Groom Lake.
Groom Lake.
Because I never heard Area 51. This is 1971, y'all. It's almost 30 years ago.
Groom Lake, folks, is right next to me here over the mountains from
right.
me. And it's the Groom Lake, dry lake bed.
Yeah, that's all I ever knew it by that name. That's the only name they ever called it. I never heard the other name, which recently contemporary everybody called
Area 51, Dreamland, whatever.
Right, Dreamland. I never heard of any of that. All I heard was just called it Groom Lake. And but I did ask Tommy's question on the maps that I had to look at, which was the federal maps, the National Forestry or Land Survey maps. I said, you dropped this thing in a place called Groom Lake. It's a big dry lake bed. I said, have y'all looked at this airplane out here? It's got rubber tires and struts. You're going to plow up to your belly in that dry lake bed. And they said, don't worry about it, kid. Get on the plane.
And so they put you on that black airplane.
Right. And we get on the DC-9, we go. And about an hour and 45 minutes, we're there. And they were right. not to worry about twin 10,000-foot runways there and intersecting taxiways. And
so you landed at Groom Lake, Area 51.
Yeah, we rolled right in there and rolled to a stop. And there's three big hangars there. And we went into the center hangar.
And by the way, for anybody who doubts that, we have on my website a picture of the so-called non-existent Area 51 taken by, I think, a Russian satellite. It is indeed a picture of Area 51, and you can see the three big hangars that David's talking about right now.
Yeah.
The biggest one being in the center.
Yeah, that's the one we went to. And when we landed there, when we did a flyover, you could see south of the facility, the parachutes. My rocket made it there, and I was pretty happy about that.
You could see your parachute?
Yeah, I could see the rocket laying on the desert floor with the parachutes.
Wow.
And I'm going, it was still smoking, and I was going, oh, God, it made it, you know, and that was...
what a thrill.
It was. I was plastered through the wind. It had put me in my seat. And so when we got off the plane, I'm ready to run to the rocket, right? So I'm starting to leave, and then I'm grabbed by these guys, and they throw me in this little golf cart thing. So I thought, all right, we're going to go see the rocket now. No, we went around the plane and headed toward the center hangar.
Huh.
And I'm going, hey, rocket's the other way, you guys, you know.
Yeah.
And they want to hear me. So we go to the center hangar, we pull in there, and we stop. And hangars are really strange-looking hangars as far as aircraft hangars. They had neat lights on top. They had these louvers over the lights, and it could light up the area, but I guess you can't see the lights from a distance.
Oh.
You know, there's just a lot of little clever little things they had around there. Being kind of a techno person, I guess, even a kid, I was a little nerdy type, I guess, I would notice a lot of technical stuff. And so when we pulled into the hangar, it's empty, but it's huge. I mean, it looks like four football fields in that thing. And we stopped out in the center of it, and then these lights come on at all the doorways, little flashing lights like you see on top of a wrecker. And these little poles come up out of the floor with chains on them, so they're like little guardrails everywhere around all the doors. And I'm going, wow, this is neat. I wonder what this is. And all of a sudden, the biggest portion of the floor drops out from under. It's an elevator. It's huge. Hangar floor is going down.
So the whole floor is dropping?
The whole floor is dropping. We go down about 200 feet.
Maybe. Wow.
About 20 stories. And the interesting thing, I was wondering what device would you use to drop such a load of concrete like this floor, plus whatever you have on top of it?
Right.
And they didn't use chains or cables or anything like that. They used worm screws, which...
Yep, that would make sense.
Same little thing that a woman turns in her lipstick to make lipstick go up and down.
Yep.
And, those big, heavy threads had tremendous load bearing. These things were huge. They must have been 10, 12 feet in diameter, and dozens of them.
So down 200 feet you go, and what's there?
Right. Well, when we get down there, the hangar floor flushes out with a floor already down there, and when we do, it's a room. Man alive, it's huge. It's a big arc-type ceiling, like a rainbow.
Now, I saw Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what that sounds like.
Yeah, I saw Independence Day, and from what I saw, on Independence Day, it was close. There was a lot. There were some changes that was different. But
do you think that they had technical advice from somebody who knew?
Yeah, I think so.
To do that movie,
somebody crawled out and talked and got a good chunk of money. Hope they left.
It should be known, you've been telling this story long before Independence Day, the movie. I just couldn't resist the parallel.
Right.
It's obvious.
Yeah. So that was a factor in deciding whether I would testify to Congress or not about this, which I did April 9th of this year under oath.
You did, under oath to Congress. Right. You told this story.
The story, and some of the factors I decided to talk about this, I've been...
Excuse me, David. To what committee did you speak?
It was a joint session of the Senate and Congress, and
really?
They did not. They had a special committee formed, and they were there at the Westin Hotel in a closed door meeting. And CSETI had orchestrated the whole setup.
Dr. Greer.
Dr. Stephen Greer.
Yes.
CSETI.
Yes.
He had me there as a witness. So, anyway.
God. And so, all right, so back down. Here we are, 200 feet down below the hangar at Area 51, center hangar.
Right.
What's there?
Well, the walls, it was just so neat the way the place was built, because with the rainbow arcing roof would come down, it just didn't come down. It cantered at the side. So what you have is all these workshops and offices built into the ground or mountainside or whatever it is, and that way it leaves the center bay open. And you could probably park a half a dozen 747s in there and not even be crowded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was big. And there were some various aircraft sitting there. I recognize one of them was an SR-71 under construction.
Blackbird?
Blackbird. And there were some other aircraft there. I'd never seen like that before. They'd like reverse teardrops. I have no idea what they were.
Reverse teardrops?
Yeah, weird-looking things. Huh. Real aerodynamic. Just think of a teardrop with some...
Oh, I can picture it. I've seen photographs of some experimental aircraft that are that.
Well, now remember, this is June 20th, 1971.
I do remember that. I mean current pictures.
Right, current pictures.
X aircraft.
Yeah, well, this stuff was all new to me. One other interesting was the way it was lit. It was completely lit, but it was like iridescent lighting. You really couldn't see direct lighting coming from anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And it was just neat. I thought that was interesting. Then we rode a little golf cart type thing for quite a ways down until we came up to a big door on, let's see, it was on our left. And the guy gets off the cart, and he goes over and he punches a keypad and puts his palm on it. And I thought that was real interesting because, you know, we never see anything like that. I saw it in James Bond movies, but...
He really put his palm on.
Yeah, he put it, and you see a light flash under his palm, and I'm going, wow, a palm scanner. I didn't even know we had that. And and just him tapping the keypad for a lock. That, you know, I never saw anything like that. So, not in the civilian world. So, of course, I was a kid, didn't have a lot of exposure, but still, you know, that stuff was not common like it is today.
Nevertheless, open sesame.
This big door opens up, and it's double thick, and this thing finally opens up. And when it opens, the lights come on. And when the lights come on, we go in, and once again, this room's lit really strange. You can look around on the floor, and there's no shadows. Like a paint booth, when you paint a car, there's no shadows in a paint booth. Because a painter can't afford to have a shadow. You get a run of paint, he won't see it.
Of course.
So that's how this entire big work bay was lit up. And I just thought that was kind of neat. So there was a huge something standing on a big, like a steel table. It was pretty long, probably about 60 feet long. But so
what was it? What did it look like?
Well, it was under tarps. And when he pulled the tarps back and went, holy cow, it's an electromagnetic fusion engine. Somewhat similar to mine.
Click, click, click. All of a sudden, here's why they've got you there.
Yeah, I went, it's obvious. I mean, I've got, well, I'm going to be modest here. Geez, I had a Wright flyer, you know, like Orville Wilbur Wright, pulled up next to a 747. You know, the power differential and the complexity is so diverse, but they both work in the same principle of flight. So my engine was about the size of a watermelon. This thing's about the size of a school bus or a Greyhound bus. It was huge, and I'm going, and I was a little disappointed. I thought I was kind of smug a little bit. You know, I thought I was kind of getting a jump on people, but obviously I wasn't, because here they had this thing sitting there, and it was just tremendous power, but it had been damaged. It had tremendous damage area in the center.
Oh, it had been as in a crash or something?
Yeah, it had actually a core breach has occurred.
All right. Hold your story. We're at the bottom of the hour. What do you think he was about to examine, folks? David T. Adair is my guest. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Ocean, finally love is love.
Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. International callers may reach Art in the Kingdom of Nye by first dialing their access number to the USA, then 1-800-893-0903, 1-800-893-0903. And you may fax Art by calling area code 702-727-8499. That's area code 702-727-8499. Please limit faxes to one or two pages. Now again, here is Art Bell.
Well, here I am. Yes, that's true. It would be fun to get some faxes from New York City. Those listening to WABC, if you're out there listening. My fax number is 702-727-8499. We are going to get the lines open at the top of the hour, maybe even before, and I am going to reserve the east of the Rockies line for the listeners of WABC in New York, celebrating their first night. All right, back now to David Adair, and here you are below this middle hangar at Area 51 of Dreamland, and you're in a special room, and they uncover this engine or this thing. I guess it's an engine, and it's partially
power plant,
and it's partially damaged. And
right.
So now you've got to conclude one of two things: either we have manufactured this, it's ours, and they're showing it to you because you have discovered a similar technology or used similar technology, or it's from elsewhere. I mean, when you look at this thing, what do you conclude?
When I first looked at it, it took me about a minute. I was standing there, and they were talking to me, and I really wasn't hearing them that well because I was just staring at this thing.
Sure.
And the first thing that really struck me is the alloys, and it's the materials made out of, and the manufacturing of it. As big as it was, there's not a single rivet, screw, bolt, seam line, weld line, nothing on it.
It's one continuous piece?
It looked like it grew. It looked like the whole thing looked like it was alive. I mean, it had what I call organic technology. Did you ever see the movie Alien with alien creatures?
Of course.
The man that does it is H.R. Geiger. And that is the kind of look this thing had.
Can you give us a visual idea of what shape it was or what it looked like?
Think of two octopuses facing each other with all their tentacles interwound with each other like they're having sex.
Okay.
And that's what it looked like.
I've never seen octopus.
Like two big round spheres.
I can imagine.
With all this tremendous piping, type ducking all through it. What that was, mine was similar in nature, but boy, this thing was just so radically different. Those, I would assume, were more like twin particle accelerators, which they would accelerate the mass, and then they would, the thing had a figure eight pattern to it. So it looked like they were converging the power into a figure eight pattern, which would make a lot of sense. It would give you an infinity loop. And then out of that infinity loop would allow you to create the electromagnetic fields you need and be a great way to sustain it, which, quite frankly, that was a great day for me because I figured it was like showing you a test, the answers to the test. And I went, cool, this will work. So then I thought, hey guys, if we have this engine, you know, we're about to launch Apollo 14. It's 1971, and I said, why are we using liquid fuel engines when you guys got this thing, you know? And they go, well, it's still pretty much experimental, son. And you can tell by the damage it's had, we're having some problems with it. And that's the reason we brought you in here. We'd like to have your opinion on it. And I went, well, where's the guys that built the thing? Well, they're not here right now. They're on vacation.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I'm sitting there, well, you got to remember, I'm a child. And so they're going to talk to you like one. So I'm sitting there going, well, they leave you any notes? And they said, well, no, but we'd like your opinion on it if you'd walk over and take a look. You want to help your country, don't you, son? And I went, yes, sir. I listened to Anita Bryant. And I did. I really did. So, But I knew something wasn't right. It just didn't feel right because I was looking at the alloys and I'm going, I have never seen anything like that in my life. And already I've seen a facility that seemed a little bit ahead of the true value hardware. So I'm going, oh, man, what have they got going here? And this thing had something running down its side, which there was a lot of devices or, I don't know what they were, contraptions on this thing. I guess they were some kind of interface or couplings for mass flows of the particle accelerator chambers. But there was a lot of devices on there I didn't recognize. And there was this one thing in particular run down its side, which the only way I can describe it, it looked like gills of a fish.
Gills of a fish?
Right. And it was like baffles, some kind of baffling system. I'm not sure what these baffles were for.
So what did they expect from you? I mean...
an opinion. That's basically what they're looking for. They asked me to take a close look at it and give them my opinion of what I think this thing is or how it functions.
Did you go up and touch it?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, I wasn't going to miss this one. And when I got to it, I said, I need to climb up on this thing, take a really good look at it. And I need to look at that damage area. That's what they want to know. They wanted my opinion what happened in that damage area.
Uh-huh.
So when I walked up to it, the first thing I noticed is there's a silhouette of me on it.
Excuse me? A silhouette of you?
Yeah. Now, what did I just tell you about the room?
There's no
shadows in that room.
Oh, that's right. That the lighting was totally even.
Right. How could there be a full silhouette of me on the engine? So I backed off and I went, it dissipates. And I got closer and it becomes really crisp. And then I moved down alongside it, and guess what? The shadow's about a half second behind you. And I went, oh, God, heat-sensitive recognition alloy. I didn't even know we had such a thing. So I told them I need to crawl up on top of it, and they said, it's fine.
Wait a minute. Heat-sensitive recognition alloy. What you're telling me is that as your shadow...
It's picking up the radiation off my body and reflecting it into a pattern.
And reflecting it into a pattern that lagged your movement a little bit?
Sure, because I moved.
Wow.
It would have to focus once you get in front of it, so you got, a little...
I understand.
A tenth of a second lag, which is kind of fun. I was waving my arms in front of it, and I looked over at them, and they were frowning a little bit because I guess they figured I'd been caught on to something already. And I'm going, this is cool. So anyway... When I grabbed hold of these panels, that was the second thing that was... it's the third thing. First thing I noticed is no seams, lines, welds, marks, nothing. It looked like it grew. Then you got this weird shadow pattern on it. And next thing that happened, when I grabbed hold of the baffle thing to pull myself up, that's where it got interesting. These baffles type things are translucent somewhat, and they're about an inch thick. And when you grab hold of them, wherever your skin is touching it, this really neat swirl-looking pattern would run through the alloy and radiate away from you. And it kind of looked like a,
I can imagine that. I mean,
like a motion wave. Remember that motion wave machine people set on a desk that goes back and forth?
Of course.
Okay, look, nice swirling wave, and it's blue and white, pretty colors. And I thought, wow, that's neat. So anyway, I'm pulling up and crawling up on top of the engine. I'm walking down this thing. And I'm walking down toward the center of it, but there's a huge hole. And I believe what has happened, I'm just going to get a closer look. So as I'm walking toward the hole, by the way, the metal looks around the blast area, it had a breach in its core. So what happened was this alloy was exposed to the internal temperatures, which these engines run 100 million degrees centigrade.
100 million degrees centigrade.
Right. This is plasma physics, and that's normal temperatures for these things. So what happened when it lost its field? The alloy was exposed to that temperature, so it was vaporizing. But what was interesting about this engine, the way apparently the blast was done, when it started occurring, it had a fail-safe system. It obviously shut itself off where it could shut that force off. And when it did, it probably took about a nanosecond, but in a nanosecond, it blew about a 4-foot hole in it, diameter. So I'm looking down in this hole.
So they'd figured out a way to shut the field down.
Yeah, whoever they are or whatever it was. And, they had a neat fail-safe system because it interrupted the plasma flow, which I hadn't thought about that. There was a lot of things I was learning off this engine. I was memorizing this thing boy, photographic memory that was real handy. It's like VCR in this thing. So then I started to crawl down the hole, and they asked me a question, and that's when I knew they were lying. They asked me, where is the circuitry? And
well, I just heard a big boom on there. Anyway, where is the circuitry?
Yeah, they asked me, where is the circuitry?
Yeah.
And I said, good question. And I started looking at it. Now, see, if you look at particle accelerators and any of the type of fusion things, I had miles of wiring in mind. The reason being is that if you remember the old Fat Boy, the atomic bomb is built like a soccer ball.
Yes, sir.
And remember all that, and there's thousands of wires going to every point of the Pentagon shape.
Right.
All right, those are wires that cause the initial blast that has to be, that's why they had such a hard time with it. It had to be a 360-degree pattern blast simultaneously blowing the particles into each other.
Oh, correct, yes.
So anyhow, this thing had no wiring anywhere. And the first question I asked, you guys didn't take the wiring off? You know, and they said no. And I'm sitting there going, now, this is their engine. This is bull. They're lying through their teeth. And I just thought, okay, well, let me look at it. So I'm looking at it, and they're right, man. There's not a single wire anywhere. But there's something else. There's a trunk case running down across this thing that looks like almost like a vertebrate column. And it's just like a big bundle of tubes, which we could call fiber optics today. But this thing, when the tubing would run across the center of the thing, it'd cascade over its sides. And then it'd break off into smaller tubes, but it was a pattern of all these thousands of tubes. And I went, this looks familiar. And I thought, good God, I've seen this before. It's a brainstem. This is a neurosynaptic.
A neural body. Network.
It's
like
a neural network running over its body. And I went, that's the circuitry. And I thought, wonder why these guys hadn't seen that. So there was a liquid in these tubes. And I could see, you know, a break in them where they had some of them drained. And I stepped down in the hole to take a look. I said, I need to step down this thing because this is such a mind rush for me. I've worked on something as small, about the size of a watermelon, and now here it is, advanced concept size, big enough you can crawl in it.
Well, I see why they had you there.
And I said, I need to step down this hole and take a look. And I said, yeah, be careful. So I get down there and I look around and I saw a bunch of other things, just outrageous stuff. And I knew right then that this is not from our technological base. It's nowhere near.
Did you raise this point with them?
Well, when I came out and I'm standing up on top, they asked me another question. They asked me, I guess this is when things went bad. They asked me if I knew exactly how the fuel was loaded. And I went, wait a minute. If this is your engine, you don't know anything about circuitry, and this is not your engine. And we have a phrase in the South, it's not from the neighborhood, is it, boys? And I said, let me guess. This is a power plant come out of an engine by the way the parameter looks. It's been ripped out or torn out. So there's a spacecraft somewhere. Where's the craft? And if it's got a craft, it's got an occupant. What'd you do with them people? And they exploded. They were so furious because I guess they realized maybe I wasn't just a naive 17-year-old techno nerd punk.
Mm.
So I got furious with them because I got hurt. What happened was I realized the country's lying to you, you know, government. You know, I really did listen to Anita Bryant when I went to sleep at night.
Yeah, those were different days.
They were.
I mean,
you know,
they really were. You're right about that.
Think
I mean,
about that. You can relate to it. I'm 43. I used to play Anita Bryant records and go to sleep listening to her. You know, and all of a sudden, it's just everything's shattered right in front of you, and you're just pissed. You're more angry and pissed than anything.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I mean, a lot of us have sort of done the same slow, except for us, it's been a slow burn through Watergate, through
right.
So many disappointments, and people have become so cynical, and for you, that occurred all at once.
Yeah, I mean, back on my bed in my little house, my mother made me an American flag, a blanket out of American flag. You know, I slept with that thing, and it just crushed me to my soul that we've been lied to. So anyway, I'm so angry, hurt. I'm getting off this engine. They started to send the little sergeants up to get me. I said, I'll get down. So I'm getting down off this thing, and I grab this baffle plate, and guess what happens, Art?
What?
It's not blue-white swirling. It looks like a red-orange tornado extending through the alloys. And I pull my hand off, stick my hands back on it, and it comes back in. Again, same thing. And I just realized what happened when I pulled away from the engine. You know what it was doing? It's not heat-sensitive recognition. It's not picking up on heat radiation. It's picking up on mental energy. It's a symbiotic engine.
Oh.
It's reading my own mental energy. When I first approached it, I was sitting there going, oh, wow, you know, awe and amazement, just having a good time. When I came down, I am angry, hurt, definitely upset, and
it reacted differently, it
visualized what I was feeling in those baffles, and I'm going, oh God, it's a symbiotic engine, this thing is recognizing mental energy.
But that absolutely makes sense with what you told us about the neural network, or what seemed
That's
to be
right.
a neural network. That makes absolute
board.
Sense.
Yeah, it all came clear, because when a pilot sits down in this thing, he was strapped in, he or it or whatever, whoever was strapped in this thing, and his brain pattern will merge with the synaptic firing order of that engine, and probably the spacecraft has its own system, so all three of them are independent ascension entities of their own, but yet a symbiotic community working with in harmony with each other.
How much more did you get to see, or did they rush you out of
that? That was it, because they grabbed me, and we went out in a hurry, but I was turning around looking at the thing, and I knew what it was. It was a symbiotic engine. Now, people out there in radio land might think, this is bull. Well, let me give you a piece of current update news here. You ever heard of Princeton University?
Yes, always.
You ever heard of McDonnell Douglas?
Of course.
Well, they're running a project with Dr. Robert John in the Pierre Lab and for the F-22 fighter. You ever heard of that?
Yes.
And what they're doing is a pilot at 1,600 miles an hour in a dogfight has no time to look at the dash. So one-tenth of a second determines whether you live or die. So what he will do, he'll think, lock, fire, and the aircraft will respond to his thought waves. Symbiotic engine technology, that's a fact. We're doing it in F-22. Where'd they get their ideas, y'all?
When you testified in front of Congress, and
right.
you told them all this.
All this. I'm facing 20 years under oath perjury sentence.
I know. I understand. What kind of reaction did you get? Did they, was it that? I mean, did they laugh?
No. I have to say, it was not a happy moment. It's interesting. It's an age thing. The younger members of Congress are standing there looking like, it stunned them, right? And they're trying to go, name of God, you know, what is this? Some of the older members, really elderly ones, they were squirming. They looked more uncomfortable. And I'm going, they know. And that's what I told them. I said, y'all know. Not all of you, but I can see your faces. I know some of you know.
Well, it's no wonder Stephen Greer brought you to Washington.
Yeah.
It's no wonder.
Steve said, I was a litmus test, and I turned pink. Actually, I turned red. I got into the testifying. I actually got angry. I really vented on him. And, One senator asked me, you're not intimidated by all this power, are you? And I said, power? I said, when you die, you're going to meet power, pal, on the other side. This is man's world. This is not power.
Well, listen, I wasn't privy to how all of the testimony. I know that you and many others testified in Washington behind closed doors.
Right.
What was the net effect of that, do you think?
You know, it was the reason I went was that Dr. Greer said there's a possibility that they may do a two-way disclosure. And I thought, you know, for 26 years I've been quiet about this story. It wasn't until March of this year I talked about it. My wife, for 15 years, I never said a word to her about this. So I've been totally quiet. And I thought, I just may get a chance to hear the rest of the story from the other side, and if I've been invited, if I don't go, I will kick myself for the rest of my life.
Now, when you left Area 51, before you left, they must have said something like, son, you keep your lips buttoned.
There was more in the story. When we went upstairs, there was a real problem we had. We ran into multiple problems. First is, they now know I'm not cooperative because I'm more ticked about this. Next thing is that I realize what they're trying to do, and what it is, they're trying to get a reverse technology on this thing.
Of course, back engineer it.
Right, and I just may give them a key to something that I really didn't want us to have right then. And what it was...
All right, David, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. I want to come back, finish that story, and then I want to take some calls. David Adair is my guest. Ah, quite a story, huh? From the high desert, you're listening to Coast AM.
Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033. That's 1-800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, call Art at 1-800-618-8255. That's 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers, dial Art at area code 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am, top of the morning, everybody. David Adair is my guest. He's a rocket scientist, a real one. And he just told you a story. The same story he told Congress a short time ago. What do you think? If you have questions for David, come now. We're going to get you on the air, and we're going to begin taking calls and let you question David. But now, look, I'm going to do something a little different tonight because it is the first night of WABC New York. So I am restricting two lines to the listeners of WABC New York. They are. My East of the Rockies line, toll-free, it's 1-800-825-5033, 1-800-825-5033, or a direct dial line, area code 702-727-1222. And I'm going to try as hard as I can. Everybody else, please don't call those lines. Let the listeners of WABC in New York call them. As we celebrate their joining the network. Or I guess we're joining them, or anyway, we're meshed or something. So the two numbers for WABC listeners exclusively over the next hour, 702, the area code, 702-727-1222, or the toll-free line, east of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. All right, tomorrow night we're going to have a very interesting gentleman here who's going to talk about what's going on with our sun, and there are some rather apocalyptic possibilities, I'm afraid. That'll be interesting. Thursday night we're going to have Dr. Michio Kaku from New York City University, who is a physics professor. He will be here talking about time travel and many of the things that I think David Adair is alluding to with respect to the engine he got to see at Area 51. And then Friday night, Saturday morning, Whitley Strieber is going to be here, author of Communion and much more, and we're going to try to get to do what we didn't get to do the other day after this incredible event in the Northwest, something streaking across the skies of Seattle, Vancouver, and points east. NORAD said it went down in the Pacific, whatever it was. That's the story, but it obviously did not go down in the Pacific. Or else NORAD was not capable of tracking what so many thousands of you saw. Anyway, this hour, it's you and David Adair. David, I want you to meet the public. I just want to finish up very quickly. What did they tell you about opening your mouth?
Well, it's a long story, but...
Short version.
The short version is I got out of there with the help of LeMay, and it was quiet for the... That was the end of my summer vacation in my junior year of high school. Uh-huh. I spent my summer vacation. So next year I graduated from high school, and I was getting ready to go to OSU, Ohio State University, in theoretical astrophysics, and I never made it because a guy from DOD stepped up in my graduation line, handed me a letter and opened it up and said, "Greetings, this June 10th, 1972. I'm drafted on the spot. And they came, got me, and they just took me. And I ended up, finally ended up spending, after we compromised, 10 years in the United States Navy.
Ten years?
So the thing was, we just kind of let it blow by, and I was quiet, and I had a 3D career, science, and I just didn't want to, I voluntarily...
Didn't want to blow your career.
No, I'm not going to say anything, guys.
And somehow, Dr. Greer of CSETI talked you into testifying.
Right, because, well, a lot of things. The Independence Day movie, the attitude of the public has shifted tremendously.
Oh, yes.
And, see, it would be suicide to do this 20 years ago. Your career would be shot.
Yep.
You wouldn't be able to interface with anything.
All right. Now, so, you understand that there are a lot of people sitting out there this morning who are going, yeah, right.
Yeah. Well,
what a fish, you know, what a fish story.
Right.
So I want to expose you to the public this hour, and also I want to get some calls from New York and New Jersey and Connecticut, you know, probably all over the Northeast. So I'm celebrating the beginning of WABC here.
Yeah,
so
congratulations.
Yes, thank you, thank you. So let us begin. East of the Rockies, top of the morning, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell, and where are you?
Good morning, David. Good morning, Mr. Bell. My name is John. I'm calling from Staten Island, New York.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Bell, I have to say, I want to welcome you to the New York area.
Thank you.
I cannot tell you how delighted I am to hear you on. I spent some time recently in the Nevada area, and I heard your show, and I was, I swear to God, I was almost praying that, boy, I wish I could hear this in New York.
Well, here we are. What is your first name, please?
John.
John, I want to remember you as the first caller I've had from WABC.
It's such an honor to be your first caller. And I got to tell you, I've been listening to your show since you came on tonight. And I heard you talking earlier about how you said you're intimidated to be on WABC.
Absolutely.
Listen, you have nothing to be intimidated about. I've been around for a long time, and this station, WABC, has gone so downhill in the last 20 years, and it is so great that you are going. I think you are going to help rebuild this station. They got all these like David Duke types, like this guy Steve Malzberg on the station, who are just terrible. And
now, don't get me in trouble.
Oh no, this won't get you in trouble. Well, actually, you know, a lot of people, they were worried that they were going to give this time slot to the Steve Malzberg, but a lot of people protested. And
all right. Before you get me washed out on my first night, ask David Adair a good question.
Can I make one more quick comment to you? I heard you had Michio Kaku on Thursday night.
Yes.
And let me tell you, he is a regular on the. I don't know if you're familiar. The Jay Diamond Show on WEVD, which is the biggest new show in New York. He's a regular on that show. You should have Jay Diamond on one night. He's wonderful, too.
Well, Michio Kaku is a genius.
Oh, Michio Kaku, and he's done some, like I said.
I've had him on, three or four times now. Anyway, before you get me totally tossed off here, ask David a good question.
Okay, David, I'd like to ask you two things. When are we going to have, I was always a big fan of the Jetsons show. When are we going to have that kind of the cars that can fly around, you know, like on the Jetsons? And also, what is your opinion of the whole thing about gays in the military?
All right, well, that's pretty, well, all right, that's an awfully diverse question. Sorry, I'm going to ignore B and go for A. He's right about that. I mean, the kind of engine that you're talking about, if it really was under control, would produce the kind of cars that they have in the Jetsons, right?
Yeah, they would. Now, I don't know whether they're going to fold up into a briefcase like George's got and walk off with it, but it's a different technological problem. But the way they're flying around, there's a machine right now being made by a guy named Mueller, and his Mueller machine is very similar to a Jetsons-type craft, and he is so far along with it that the FAA is trying to figure out how to determine a license for it, because the thing can fly, land, pull into, he did a demonstration, pulled into a driveway at a McDonald's, drove off into a parking lot, took off and flew away. Now, is it a DMV license or is it an FAA license? See, there's all kinds of confusion here. So, but yeah, we're closing in on that type of technology.
So the answer is soon, huh?
Right, very soon.
God, I would love that. First time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair. Where are you, please?
New York, New Kennedy Airport.
Oh, well, all right. Welcome to the program. I guess you're my number two WABC caller.
Well, I called to tell you, welcome to New York City. I have been listening to you since July on three very scratchy 50,000-watt stations. I am so glad to have you on the New York affiliate. I cannot begin to tell you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's good to know that we were heard in New York, sort of.
It was awful. Most of the time I heard you over the Internet. But I'm really glad. I mean, I can hear you without static for once.
Without static, that's right.
I don't have a question for you, for your guest. I just wanted to tell you I'm glad you're here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you very much for the call. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to find out if the fusion engine related to the hypothesis of coal fusion that was controversial a few years ago.
All right. Where are you, by the way?
Staten Island,
another New York. All right, it's a good question. I think the answer is no, but we'll ask.
It is no. It's the same process, but apples and oranges are both fruit, but they're totally different of each other.
In other words,
cold fusion is what it is, cold. This is
very hot.
Yeah, this is very hot on the.
Again, with temperatures that reach.
Right, 100 million degrees centigrade. And you're pulling out of hydrogen reaction with water, where this is fueled, at least mine was, with deuterium trienium.
Gotcha. Wild card line, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hello, this is Vince in Chicago.
Hey, Vince.
Mr. Adair, this is quite a shocking story. I know you firsthand have seen the black operations over there at Area 51, and I'm a little shocked and uncomfortable with the idea of a former Nazi running around in a black DC-9 having anything to do with the black operations over there.
Oh, don't kid yourself, sir. A lot of former Nazis ran around in our rocketry programs. In fact, many, many, many. It's a great untold story. Right, David?
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. You should be shocked and a little concerned. That is not a healthy situation.
You know, and it kind of reminds me of one of the stories that Richard Hoagland was talking about on September 12th of this year, when he showed the photo of the Mars Pathfinder, and on a plaque on the Pathfinder there was a swastika and a skull and the Palomar Observatory.
And by the way, Vince, for your edification, I talked to Richard Hoagland earlier in the day, and he's done a lot more work on Pathfinder. Expect a show with him in the next few days. No, there's no great mystery about the fact that the Nazis were, in fact, very much part of our early space program. After the war, we kind of divided the Nazis up, didn't we, between the Russians and the Americans, and then the race began.
The superpower is born out of the same pot.
Yeah. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Where are you, please?
New York. More greetings from New York.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome.
You are absolutely the most brilliant talk show host I've ever heard.
I don't know about that.
How long are they going to let you stay on before they get hip to what you're saying and we tune in and you're not going to be there?
Well,
you know what I mean. I'm going to go running nude in the street and stalk my radio station.
Well, you wouldn't even be noticed in New York City if you do that.
Actually, I lied a little bit. I'm calling from New York, but I'm calling from outside of Niagara Falls, New York.
You'll really be noticed up there.
A place of much electromagnetic charge.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just have to say, I didn't catch your whole guest's talk tonight, but... I just have to say, of all the people that I have heard give sort of their testimonial to what we all know and have known for a long time, at least people like myself, is true, he is probably the most credible-sounding authority that, or eyewitness.
I put him up there. I'll tell you what. I put David up there with Colonel Corso. I don't know if you've had an opportunity ever to hear Colonel Corso.
I probably have, but I just am not placing the name.
All right. Colonel Corso claims and wrote a book called The Day After Roswell, and he claims, I've interviewed him several times. I heard you say, oh, yes. And he introduced, he says, a lot of technology from a crash at Roswell into American private sector industry that accounts for a lot of what we have now, fiber optics and the transistor and bunch of things.
I just have to ask you, Art, are you familiar with a woman? She was a channeler, and she has been channeling messages similar to what your guest the other night was talking about, the intuitive communication process. I believe that's definitely going on with mass numbers in our population around the globe, so that when we do more than likely reach that electromagnetic zero that Greg Braden was talking the other day, so that they can facilitate this change.
Let me ask David about that. David, I had Greg Braden on, brilliant guy, and he contends, and tomorrow night's guest is going to wind right into what he was talking about, that the Earth's magnetic field, and he can document it, is less by a factor of, well, if it was a 10 a few thousand years ago, it's 1.5 now,
right,
and that we're approaching a zero point, a center
right.
point, and that eventually we'll simply stop, there will not be any gravity whatsoever, and then there will be a pole reversal. Are you familiar with that?
Right.
And that the Schumann frequency, the actual vibratory frequency of the Earth, has been increasing.
I don't know about the gravity part, but you're absolutely right about a polar reverse. The Earth's core has showed us through archaeological meteorology that the Earth has reversed its poles several times already. But being the fact that the last time it did it, there wasn't any modern man or anybody around, we don't know about the gravity part. So we'll have to wait and see. But it's just an absolute science fact that the poles have reversed themselves at least half a dozen times.
David, if everything you've said is true tonight, then it's the biggest lie that man has ever told and kept. How do we break all of this open? How do we say enough is enough? I've had a million guests very much like you, people who have seen the things that you say you've seen. It's such a giant lie. How do we break it all open? Any thoughts?
If you can get across to the public, or if the public can get across to the government, a feeling of, I know this is a word not used very much, where it's called forgiveness, but if the government would do a full disclosure, which at the time they made those decisions, they thought they were making the best decisions at that time.
I don't doubt that.
And they really weren't a bad bunch of people. They're just trying to handle a bad situation. And, you know, you just come out of World War II, one of the bloodiest confrontations on the planet. You're going to tell a world-weary war that you may now have to fight an intergalactic battle. You know, yeah, sure, you're going to tell them that.
So, in other words, if they felt they wouldn't get their political heads or their literal heads chopped off.
Right. That if they would disclose, and we're all, you know, hey, we'll forgive you, we'll go on and deal with this information, and let's share it and get it out here and work with it, and not be vindictive about it, if they do an honest, full disclosure on their part, I think they're looking for a way out. You know, the question I had for the Congress was, why do you guys let this hearing happen? There's no reason for you guys to let Dr. Greer and CSAG have this hearing unless you guys are being pushed by something.
And what did they say?
It was dead quiet. I mean, it was E.F. Hutton in the room. And I smiled at him and said, let me guess, is somebody coming to dinner and it's not Sidney Poitier? And they did not look happy at all.
I hear you. All right, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Hello.
Hello. How you doing tonight?
I'm fine. Where are you?
Well, this is my first time calling. This is the only number I could get down right away, but I'm calling from Tempe, Arizona.
Tempe, all right.
Yeah, I wanted to say hello, David.
Hey.
And I wanted to say that I am an experiencer, and I have had contact with extraterrestrials. I can't get into that right now, but David, I'm an artist, and I have a visual conception of the description you gave of this
engine.
Yeah, this engine.
Propulsion
and
system.
I was wondering exactly, I'm trying to form a mental picture here, where exactly were the gills set up on the sides? Were they on the tentacles or on the bulbs on the ends? And where exactly did you see the fiber optic brainstem, so to speak?
All right.
The gill patterns were running around the two bulbs here, right. You're the first person ever asked me that. And the neural network pattern was running down across the top of the way the engine was setting on top of the bulbs.
To down below.
Right.
All right, David, hold on. Yes, we're at the bottom of the hour. The clock rules, and I've got to break away. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell with David Adair. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies. Dial 1-800-825-5033. That's 1-800-825-5033. Now, here again is Art Bell.
Do you have any idea what you've heard this morning? My guest is David Adair, and he'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. This, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. Pretty weird, but it's right on the money. What do you think?
You may still have time, you might still get by. Every time I think about it, I want
to. Do you think our government really is doing everything David says and more? Imagine, that was how many years ago, and if they were doing that then, what do you think they might be doing now? By the way, in addition to my fax number, you can email me at artbell, that's A-R-T-B-E-L-L, at AOL.com, artbell@AOL.com. I get a lot of mail. All right. David, are you there? Hello, David. David Adair. David Adair, where are you? David? David, David,
yes.
David, David, are you there?
Yes.
Don't walk away from the phone like that, David. All right, first-time caller line, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell.
This is Sal from Long Island City, New York.
Hello, Sal.
Thank you. I'm asking, David, can you narrow down the size of that engine more specifically? I know you said it's the size of a bus, but a minibus, a commercial bus,
no.
A school bus. And I'd like to tell you why I'm asking.
Okay.
I've just finished
reading a Greyhound.
Hello?
A Greyhound.
A Greyhound, but big.
Yeah.
So that suggests that it didn't come from the craft that crashed at Roswell.
No, no. This thing, if anything, would have been the size of the craft at Roswell. If this is something.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. You were going to say why you were asking the question.
Well, that's the reason, because that suggests then that they got this from another craft. Something else crashed, and it was even bigger than the thing that came down at Roswell.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? I think a lot of things come down that we're not told about, my friend.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard back in New York, but there was a gigantic flap in Seattle and Vancouver this last Friday, something gigantic.
I was listening.
Oh, you were?
Program. Yes,
oh, you were. All right.
I was right there with you.
All right. Well, the official NORAD/Air Force explanation is an SL-12 rocket splashed into the Pacific.
Yeah. Other people saw it inland, saw it hovering, saw it moving slowly like
that's
a shrimp.
Right. You've got it.
And saw 10 or 12 objects.
Thousands.
10 to 15.
Thousands of people, sir.
That's right.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. David?
Yes.
You think that's true? I mean, you know, we hear about crashes of things reentering, things landing, stories from South America, stories from Mexico where UFOs are so common. In fact, they've had airliner collisions in Mexico.
Right.
I mean, incredible stories. So it may well be that things have come down over the years, not just at Roswell, but all over the world. South Africa, you get stories. Do you think that's true?
Oh, yeah. If somebody's coming to visit this planet, they're not just going to focus on the United States. We're not the center of the world, y'all. You know, they're going to go all over the planet. So it'd be everywhere. And it's possible, you know, in this country we have an open democracy and freedom of information, all that stuff. Other countries you have military control. So if something goes down over there, it's really easy to cover it up.
I think even here, I'll tell you something. I'll tell you something, David. Out here where I am, serious cactus country. You know the kind of country it is.
Sure do.
Experimental aircraft go down out here from time to time, and when they do, David, a cordon goes up around the crash site. Nobody gets anywhere near it. They've got guards. They've got vans, special vans, all kinds of stuff. And you don't get anywhere near
it. And they're fast.
Man, are they fast.
They can be on a site so fast you can't believe it.
That's right. That's exactly correct. We're not that different. Democracy, yes, but military control, you betcha. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Art, this is Lauren, and I'm calling you from New Jersey.
Hi, Lauren.
And I'm so happy that you've moved over to WABC. I found you on 1450, which is New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
It's a 1,000-watt station, and at night we lose you terribly. I found you again on 1100 from Cleveland, which is a 50,000-watt station, and it came in better. And I got the real talk, and it's going to make such a difference.
Now you're going to be able to start and just tape me, and it'll be solid as a rock.
I'm a big fan of the Sea Crane Company. In fact, they have my Real Talk right now, and they're trying to get me an outside antenna hookup so that I can get you better on either of those two stations. I don't even need that anymore.
They can do it. Believe me, they can do it.
Yeah, they're doing it. They're great people.
Anyway, have you a question for David?
I wanted to tell him that it's a fascinating program, and yes, I was listening on Friday when you were talking about everything happening out in Seattle, and pretty scary stuff. That's basically, you know, the only comment I can make. It's pretty scary stuff because I know they don't tell us everything, and I believe the government does hold back on a lot of stuff. But
yeah,
if they did tell us everything, where would we be anyway? You know? So it's up to you to get it out.
All right. Thank you very much. That's, I guess, what we're doing. You know, I vacillate a little bit, David. On the one hand, this area, you know, I get people emailing me, Art, why don't you lead a million man march and go crash the gates at Area 51?
Really?
This kind of stuff. And I've got a lot of respect for our government, even as cynical as I may have become. We have a right, a duty, maybe even an obligation, to keep some secrets. I mean, we develop aircraft. The Stealth 117 came out of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other things that I probably don't even know about and probably don't want to know about. So I vacillate. I mean, there should be openness on the one hand. The Cold War is over, maybe, and it's time to tell. But then on the other hand, the Cold War really isn't over.
Right, and you got the industrial espionage on the other side where we, in order for us to keep our competitive edge planet-wide,
yeah,
there are some things we just cannot let out. And the industrial-military complex triad is so tight, it's hard to unravel one side without undoing the other.
If you had irrefutable, absolute evidence in your hand, how long would you think before you released it?
You mean evidence of extraterrestrial life?
Sure.
If I
have evidence that our government for some time has been in collusion with this life in one way or the other, that we have technology from it, you know, the whole thing.
Right. If I was working within the government?
No, just right now. David Adair.
Oh, me?
Yep.
If I had it?
Yep.
I'd tell you tomorrow.
Well,
because
actually, you told me today, but I mean, if you really had the hard evidence.
I would, because there is a certain technology or certain knowledge that is intrinsic throughout all of society. People have the right to know this. The fact that you've made contact with an alien life form of another planet, intelligent life, you do not have that right to hold that information. It is wrong because it affects every single person on the planet. Therefore, they should know about it. Good or bad, whatever, we'll experience it together. But it's a universal thing that involves everyone. If it was a smaller piece of information where it's like it's a patentable thing or something we can make a project or a widget with, that's a different story. But when you hit something as major Earth-relative human being across the board, it affects everybody. You don't have that right to hold that information. I told them that in area, well, Groom Lake. I told them, I said, you know, you guys don't have the right to hold this back.
What did they say?
It's a matter of national security. And I went, you still don't have that right.
Here's a question from Roger. David recounted that when he looked more deeply inside of the engine and around it, he saw some incredible things that confirmed his suspicions that there was no way it could be of terrestrial origin. Would you elaborate a bit on what you might have seen that said that to you, aside from the engine?
As a sharp listener out there, he's got his ears up.
Yep.
There are some things that... some devices and other things. This engine was not dead. It was not just a piece of metal. This thing was alive. It was still alive. And there's just stuff I can't go into, but there was just, there's just things. And, you know, I'll throw another piece of thought out there. Don't assume that they just recently acquired this thing. It could have been millions of years old, and they could have dug it up. That's an assumption we're making. I never did. I don't know how old it is. I don't know its point of origin. I don't know who made it. I know it's not from a technological database, anything of that time period.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't ours, wasn't theirs, being the Soviets. But I knew that it was not from our technological base.
Seeing all that you saw had to have changed your life forever.
yeah, it's difficult. It's like I can appreciate Vietnam soldiers living with delayed action syndrome. It's something that really eats on you every day, and you just have to deal with it. Fortunately, my profile in the Navy, I was born with really good compartmentalization.
Are you not worried that one of these days, you know, there's going to be a knock on your door and a couple guys in suits there, and they're going to say, Mr. Adair, come with us?
Well, if that time comes, I just have to deal with it. You know, the whole thing about all of this is like if we live in paranoia and give into it, we'll feed that energy, and you will become a prisoner of it. The worst that they can do is kill this body of mine. They're not going to take my free spirit or my free choice, and they can throw me in prison and do what they want to me. By God, they can't. Some things they can't pull out of me. So, you know, I've had this done to me since I was a kid. What else can they do? They can come and get me or whatever. But once again, that's the paranoia thing. I've never caught any negativism from the government about any of this. As a matter of fact, even the Senate and Congress exonerated me. So the reason why, they know it's a true story. I think what it is, I've still got a gut feeling they're trying to find a way out. They're looking for anybody that can help.
All right. Let's go back to it and say good morning, East of the Rockies. You're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Hello. Oh,
hello,
there.
Hi.
Now you're on the air. I'm sorry.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you quite well. Thank you. Where are you?
Hi, my name is Scott, and I'm calling from the Bronx, New York.
All right, Scott.
Nice to be on with you, and I can tell you, I love your. I've heard you for the last 3 hours, and I think you're great. And I'm going to call the station tomorrow, and I think they should put you on Saturday night. They have Dead Air from about midnight to 6 a.m.
Dead Air.
And I think they should really put your. They should put tapes. If I don't know if you have reruns, maybe you could give them.
Oh, we are on Saturday and Sunday. They have Dead Air.
Oh, they're going to play you on Saturday and Sunday?
Maybe well, no, I don't know. I don't know that, but I know I'm better than Dead Air.
They have Dead Air from about midnight on Saturday night to 6 a.m.
I'm at least better than Dead Air.
Oh, you're better than everything on this station.
Well, anyway, sir.
I can tell you, I'm in the radio business, but I can tell you're going to get a call.
First time callers, area 702-727-1222.
I hope you're not going to let them because.
No. Look, do me a favor.
Yes.
Stop before you get me eliminated.
Oh, don't worry.
Listen, do you have a question for Dave? Call the wild card lines, area 702-727-1295.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Can I ask you, what is the, someone brought this up before, what do you think of the whole gays in the military thing?
Gays in the military, all right.
Okay. Well,
all right, well, go ahead and answer. You were in the military for how many years?
10 years.
10 years.
If they keep it contained to themselves, it's their personal preference, and they don't interfere with me or any of my thought processes during my normal course of daily life and living, that is their business.
You know, it's my attitude as well, and my attitude about gays has always been what they do in the privacy of their own whatever is their biz, keep their hand off my knee, and we're cool.
That's it.
However, would it be disruptive in a combat kind of situation? I'm still mulling that one over. I don't know.
If they can shoot a gun and fight and get an enemy off of me that's trying to kill me, I don't care. But, you know, if they've got the same tenacity as any other combat soldier, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I would think in the end it would hang on whether combat effectiveness was degraded or not degraded. And we won't know that until some years pass. So the experiment continues, I guess.
My personal feelings is I consider it wrong. But that doesn't mean I'm going to persecute them either. That's wrong too. It's not my place to judge. I didn't create their life. I'm not.
Yeah, you know, politically, I'm pretty much of a libertarian. You know, hands off me, hands off you, that
right.
kind of thing. And
but my personal opinion, you know, I'm also pre-traditional, which to me it's wrong. But that's not my place to decide.
Okay. Glad you answered it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello there.
Hi. How
Hi.
You doing?
Where are you?
I'm in South Texas.
South Texas.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do you have a question?
Yeah. I wanted to ask him if he would make any connection to the AFTI program.
STI?
SDI? No, AFTI. Advanced Fire Technology Integrated.
What does that stand for, that acronym?
Advanced Fighter Technology Integrated.
Oh, I think he mentioned that a little bit earlier.
Yeah, with the Pierre Lamb in New Jersey with research done with McDonnell Douglas on the F-22. They're trying to incorporate now their symbiotic technology where the craft could read the thoughts of the pilot. But also they ran into an interesting problem there, Art. They're having to do a reversal with the system. Sometimes they have to screen the pilot's thoughts away from the craft.
Say that again?
Well, they have to screen the pilot's thoughts away from the craft because it could get him killed. For instance, the pilot goes home that night.
Yeah.
He or she catches their mate in bed with a whole bunch of other people. So they're having a bad day. Next morning, they got to strap in that fighter, and they're not concentrating. If the aircraft can sense their frustration, they could hesitate. And if it hesitates in a tenth of a second in a dogfight, it makes a difference between you live or die.
Yep. That's for sure. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, this is Sandy from Las Vegas.
Hello, Sandy.
Hello, Mr. Adair. I had a chance to see you when you were here last year with the Whole Life Expo.
Oh, okay.
And I really must compliment you. This is the fourth time I've heard a little bit of your story, and you're an excellent speaker.
Yeah.
You make it fresh every time. A couple things you shared, I don't know if you've shared them on the program, if you're willing to. You made a comment one time that one of the telescopes we have in space, the pictures go to a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And also you made a comment about something that's housed in a Jesuit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like you to share that with some other people
sure.
also.
Yeah, like me. I haven't heard any of this.
Right.
A satellite that
well,
goes...
Well, the Hubble telescope, the command center, is in John Hopkins Hospital.
What?
Go look it up. That's exactly where it's at. The private contractor is housed at the John Hopkins Hospital. This is a dangerous thing when they play words in the space arena. They say they're privatizing the space program. That's not the word you want. You want commercializing. When they privatize, you get this situation. This private contractor that receives command signals from the Hubble telescope, the images, does not have to show you what he sees for 6 months. Unacceptable. And that's the way the status quo is right now. So I believe in real time, like the Viking 76, when it lands there, we see it live, uncut, not delayed, and we see it together. The other thing she talked about, can I show you this thing? The National Technology Transfer Center of NASA. Okay, what do you think the headquarters of that should be? That's where we transfer the technology?
Where do I think it is? Houston,
well,
probably.
Well, it should be like where it was, Washington, D.C. or Houston. No, you know where it's now? Look it up. Jesuit College, Wheeling, West Virginia.
Jesuit College?
It's in the middle of a Jesuit college.
What?
I'll give you the 1-800 number to it.
No.
Anyhow, the thing is, how to get there? Well, ask the Pope of Pork Barrel, Senator Byrd. And it's a bad situation. They tried to bury the Technology Transfer Center, and they stuck it up there to kill it.
Oh, Senator, I've got a highway for you, Byrd.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
him.
Oh, I see. But at a Jesuit college.
Yeah, it's in the middle of its address. I'm looking at it right here, Jesuit College, Wheeling, West Virginia. And you can call 1-800.
No. Don't give that out. A million people will call it, and we will bring their business to a total halt, whatever their business is.
It doesn't
is.
Matter. They wish they could get some business. I work with them, and they feel buried and isolated. Because they are such a commercial enterprise, they do so well with space. And right now, NASA's policy is they're not that interested in commercializing space if he is as a competitor.
All right. Well, you've given people all over lots to chew on, David. Stand by. In some markets, we'll be back with one more hour for David. Oh, my. So, this is something for you all to think about, a little or a serious amount of brain food. Could what he has said be true? And if so, what does that tell us about our own government? Are you surprised? Or are you so cynical by now that you're ready to believe just about anything? Time to set it all free, let it all out. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
To talk with Art Bell from west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, dial 1-800-618-8255. That's 1-800-618-8255. Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am. Good morning. David Adair is my guest, rocket scientist, guy who has testified in front of Congress, and if you have a question for him, we'll try and concentrate as hard as we can on the lines in the last hour. Now, back to Georgia and David Adair, where it must be after 5 o'clock in the morning.
That it is.
So you're a good trooper. Doing very well. First time caller in line, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Where might you be?
I'm in Albany, New York. I'm a truck driver. Mr. Bell, I'd like to thank you for your show.
Thank you.
There's plenty of us out here, I'm sure, that would like to thank you for your show. You keep us awake at night. David, I'd like to ask you a question. Is there a thing as magnetic propulsion?
Oh.
Yes, there is. We don't have any working prototypes that I'm aware of right now. But the theory on the magnetic propulsion systems, that was one of the 60 engines I talked about earlier that NASA has identified we could use and just need to build them.
How, if you can explain to a layman, thank you, caller, would a magnetic engine work?
There's varieties of ways they can work. One simple way is for a craft that would be able to focus its energy of a gravity field on a planet. A gravity field of a planet can be the way it flows from north to south poles, can gravitate in what would be related to aircraft flying vectors. And you can just simply polarize them to the beams by using a reactionary process of the magnets, of whether it's positive or negative charge, and you would propel or either pull or push away from that power. You could travel scooting across the surface of a planet. You could also go from planet to planet.
Wouldn't that, though, let's assume that you're pushing for the sake of our mm-hmm. conversation, that would require an incredible amount of push energy to defy gravity within the atmosphere, surely.
It would require an extreme concentrated source.
So there would be gravity amplifiers. There would have to be a source, a generation of artificial gravity, and then an amplification
right.
and a direction of it, right?
Right. Well, the big assembly block, you already said, anti-gravity. To get an anti-gravity field, right now, as far as I know, there is no such thing as anti-gravity available to 3D science. If it was, we wouldn't be using rocket engines. A lot of people say it exists. Well, just give me a phone call. We'll make money. That's one of the big stumbling blocks, is that we haven't been able to master the anti-gravity effect yet, at least on a mass scale where we get a big prototype engine like that.
With reference to a guest I'm going to have on tomorrow night, could you think of the Earth and the gravity field as a toroid?
As a what?
As a toroidal type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be. They're hard to say. They're interrelated upon each other, as in physics. So I don't know what the other aspect would be on them. Is he relating it to any type of mental activity?
I don't want to give this away because
okay.
it's going to be very, very interesting tomorrow night. You already answered my question. You'll be interested in my guest tomorrow night. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair. Hello.
Good evening, Art, and good evening, Mr. Adair. It's Robert from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Adair, I would hope, I have two things for you, sir. Number one, I would hope that before you become deceased, that you would consider very strongly doing an autobiography of your experience and of your life.
Yeah, you know, that's a pretty good point. David, have you written a book?
I have a book written. It's about 450 pages, and it's called America's Fall from Space. And it's not published yet, and the reason it's not published is I'm in the process of doing a movie deal right now.
Wow.
They're doing a movie on my life story.
Wow.
Great. Number two, sir, just based on what you were saying, when you touch that device out there and the impulses or whatever that took place when you touched it, I get the gut feeling that once you're on the inside there, sir, that you must have been having some things that transport you telepathically or whatever, which I would love to be able to sit down and talk with you.
Because I have a career going here and a life, that's one of the reasons I don't get into it. But your assumption is pretty much correct.
Really?
Interesting events that did occur.
Really?
Yeah.
So even now, David, there are some things that you would prefer not to discuss.
Right. There was it was lifelong exchange of information, you might say. So there was
I understand. You need not say another word. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Good morning.
Art Bell, this is Jason from Seattle.
Hi, Jason.
David, first of all, just curious if you got your rocket back.
No, I never did.
I didn't think so. Second of all, I'm very interested in the physics of this engine. Would you say it had interstellar capability, and if so, could you elaborate a little bit on maybe how it operated?
Are you referring to his engine or
no,
to
no,
the one?
No, the very large engine that you brought.
Okay.
Excellent question.
Yes.
Very excellent question. He's absolutely right. It's not just a propulsion system. It's a power plant, which one form of this type of energy could take the form of a small reactor the size of a standard office desk that could supply all the power to New York City on a chunk of fuel the size of your thumbnail for 100 years. That's the type of fusion reaction that you can have in these fusion reactors. But on the other side, it can be an outrageous propulsion system. And it can solve a riddle. I'm sure this engine could do it. You could go millions of times faster than the speed of light without breaking the speed of light. Now, how is that possible?
Yes, that would have been my question.
The engine itself, as we talked about earlier, is contained in a fusion reaction, the power of a sun. Okay, how in the world do you contain an H-bomb with an electromagnetic graviton field? Well, how does that work? There's only one thing in the universe we know that can hold the power of a sun. It's called a black hole. It swallows the sun, which are
billions of
H-bombs going off simultaneously, swallowed, gone forever, never seen again.
Yep.
Obviously, it doesn't have a problem containing it. Well, then, therefore, this field that you have artificially created within its engine is an artificial black hole in effect. Yes, it is. The next thing that you can do, which I never had time to get the research on it, was phase two. That is to take that field and do a double stack, like a stack of donuts. Outside, one stack inside containing the engine, the second stack containing the spacecraft. Then what happens is, let's say out in front of you on a linear track, point A to point B, you're looking at 100,000 light years distance. Well, there's no way that you're going to be able to live long enough to get 100,000 light years done, even at the speed of light. However, like there's only one other thing in the universe that bends space. It's called a black hole. So you have an artificial black hole extended outside your craft. What happens is, just like paper wrapping around you, a burrito theory is what I call it. Space starts wrapping like a burrito around you real tight. And then what you have to do is only travel the linear distance of a single width of an edge of a burrito.
If you shut it off,
you end up on the other side, and you have went millions of times faster than the speed of light without breaking the speed.
All right, I have had some guests that have described it this way. Take a sheet of paper.
That's what I could do. Yeah.
And you think of an ant crawling from one side of the paper to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ant's got a long way to go for an ant.
Unless.
But if you take the paper and you fold the paper.
Roll it.
Suddenly, or roll it, then suddenly the ant, gee whiz, he's there.
He's there at about the width of his body.
He's on the other side.
Exactly. And you've went the same distance without breaking or disturbing any universal laws. And that's theoretical astrophysics, and it does work.
All right. And by the way, you are in agreement with Professor Kaku. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm calling from East Meadows, New York.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I got a question to David.
Yes, sir.
Hey, David, you last time I heard you talk, you said you blew up your rocket.
Right.
One?
Yeah, sure did.
By using the graphite grease, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, you also made mention that your rocket, if it was launched out in space, would go the speed of light?
No, in linear propulsion it would, because the minute that you have that kind of fusion matter coming out the exhaust area, just the old Newtonian laws will take over for every action. There's an opposite and equal reaction. Since the matter is leaving at the speed of light out the exit port and specific impulse of the engine, which is the orifice area, in a matter of short time, you should be able to catch up to that velocity.
It would not, though, exceed the speed of light, would it?
No.
It would reach, or almost reach, the speed of light, which...
Right.
It wouldn't actually reach, because my understanding of physics is if you actually reached the speed of light, you would become infinite.
Right. It's an infinite curve. The only way to get around that problem, which I have no idea of doing, you would have to create some kind of, some kind of infinite curve dampener that would stop the effect of that kind of curvature problem.
All right. So the answer, caller, is with that kind of propulsion system, you would reach very nearly the speed of light.
Okay, if you would go that fast, would the outside temperature of your craft reach a certain temperature where it would blow up?
No, not if you're in deep space, only if you're in an environmental area that you would run into a temperature problem, like passing through a sun.
Hmm.
But the interesting thing about that, though, keep in mind, this is all still theoretical, because we've never been able to get anything to do this yet. But in theory, that the craft should reach almost the speed of light, which it would be so much of a small difference you wouldn't be able to perceive it. But what would happen on the outside, the craft itself would become basically an energy particle. And if that happens, all right, you could have a spacecraft the size of an aircraft carrier pass right through you, through your house, out the planet, and keep getting it, and not disturb you. And yet, inside the spacecraft, it would be relative to the occupants, and they wouldn't know any difference.
Wow.
It's very possible for a vehicle to be traveling that fast, pass right through a planet. That's why when you're decelerating, your navigation is extremely important, that you don't start rematerializing inside a sun or a planet.
No, very, very uncomfortable indeed. You would just go...
That's it. You'd be an unhappy camper at that moment.
You would be fuel, exhausted instantly.
Well, you'd be as a matter reaction explosion. They wouldn't even see you. Just see a supernova somewhere out there.
Great. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Where are you, please?
In Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, yes, sir.
Mr. Adair, earlier in the program, did I misunderstand you, or did you say that the aircraft you called the Vomit Comet flew up to, like, 90,000 feet?
No, I said, did I say 90,000? Yeah.
I thought that's what you said.
No, maybe I got confused a second. You'll get 90 seconds of free fall.
Right, right.
And, that'd be at the edge of space, just about. If I said that indeed, then I made an error. I've got unit of time and measurement there confused.
I was just curious to that effect, because I have performed maintenance on that very aircraft.
Oh, okay.
No, it wouldn't go up that far.
High.
I flew in the Concorde, and I got to fly at about 65,000 feet, and I can't imagine a conventional aircraft going to 90,000.
No, I know you get about 90 seconds free fall, but what altitude do you guys hit?
Oh, they usually do that around 35,000 to 40,000.
Oh, okay.
They fly a series of long, slow arcs.
Right, hyperbolic curve.
Yeah, I get that 90 seconds of free fall in it.
Yeah.
And I can imagine why it got its name, too. I bet they cleaned up in there a lot.
I was getting ready. I was going to ask you a question. That's maintenance. Do you have friends or you? Do you have to clean that thing up now?
He's gone, but,
okay.
You don't. I know the answer to that one.
yeah, they do.
First time caller line. You're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Richard.
Where are you, Richard?
Ramona.
Ramona, California?
Right. No, Ramona in the bedroom.
No, I'm not.
Where are you?
Ramona, California.
Ramona, California. All right.
Yeah.
And you're right. My Ramona's in the bedroom.
Mine's in her room. I'm 47, and approximately 12 years ago, I better shut the radio. I was in a state hospital in Massachusetts, and there I met Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. And it's not funny, but they were totally wiped out.
You know, I'm not going to go further with that, except to say this. Most of the astronauts, the majority of astronauts, have had, you know, whether or not you believe the story he just told, have had severe marital, mental, and just about every kind of breakdown type trouble you can imagine, David.
Mm-hmm.
You got any idea why that might be?
Yeah, for some of these men, it's pretty obvious. They hammer at a gold, where this becomes their only gold in life and their career, which is the pinnacle for them to be able to, like, fly to the moon and back. Well, when they come back, it's such an emotional letdown personally, because what do you do to top that? And it leaves them hanging, and a lot of them were just not mentally and emotionally set for that.
Well, that is one scenario. Another is that they became aware of things that, that they could not talk about, and that kind of thing eats you alive.
There hasn't been anyone that's been in space that has not had some kind of personal, spiritual...
boy, isn't that true.
Some kind of event that occurred to them that has, when they come back, they all come back a little different.
Different. Maybe more than a little, too.
Right, and it varies in individuals, but there's not a single one of them that's been out there has not been moved by it, and they all will tell you that.
Yep. All right, let's try one more quick. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Where are you, please?
Albany, New York.
All right.
The last time David was on, I believe he mentioned he was working on a book. Is that true, David? Is that...
Yeah, you just mentioned that.
Right.
He's got a book.
I'm sorry, I'll just check out your reviews on WABC, which are fantastic.
Oh, you mean, how do you get reviews on WABC?
I'm flipping stations. They're off the air right now with you. They're on to their morning show.
Oh, I see.
I'm flipping between Philadelphia and 12 and WABC to see how your reviews are coming in. They're coming in great.
You mean you get instant reviews in there?
Instant reviews. But I must have missed what you said about your book. I apologize.
All right. The answer is over a 400-page book.
Book called America's Fall from Space, which is going to become a movie. I'm working with the studios now in negotiations on that. I got to fly out to Hollywood on Thursday. I hadn't had time to tell you that, Art.
So there you are. They're going to do his life story,
right.
And but the book is not available, and so
not yet. I'm waiting. I'm going to end up letting the studios do it for
so
me.
So we don't even have anything to sell you.
Okay, well, great to hear. Congratulations on New York City, Art.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, bye.
Take care.
There is one thing, Art. I do have 4 different videotapes, each of them an hour long, and they're on Apollo 13, Helium 3, Challenger, and space technology spinoffs. And I've made these in special effects studios, and I just made these in the last few months.
Well, we do have some to sell you.
Yeah, so
right.
I have a whole string of videos that...
And I bet you even have an 800 number?
No, I don't have a 1-800 number, but I'll give you a mailing address. You can send for the mailing list or the catalog, or it's not catalog, the list of the videotapes, and it tells you...
What is the address, real quick?
The address is 108 Park Place, just like on Boardwalk, Park Place, Stockbridge, one word, S-T-O-C-K, Bridge, Stockbridge, Georgia, 30281.
Give that zip code again.
30281.
All right, and we'll give that again before the end of the program. So if you want to know more, there's one way to know more, or you can wait for the movie. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Slip off to a sand dune, real
is talking to first-time callers at area code 702-727-1222. That's area code 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye. Now again, here's Art.
The Kingdom of Nye, indeed. It is a kingdom out here. All right, a lot of people, no doubt, were trying to write down that address toward the end of the last half hour. Let's give it to them one more time, David.
Okay. It's 108 Park Place.
Park Place.
Park Place. Stockbridge. Stockbridge, Stockbridge, Georgia, 30281.
All right. How much are the videotapes?
They're 20 each.
$20 each.
Right.
And what are they, the titles of each?
The titles are Challenger and Apollo 13, Helium 3, and Space Technology Spinoff, which is Space of Waterly Use.
You know, you should have told me about these hours ago.
Well, I tell you what, I'm not used to being a merchant or a salesman. I'm a scientist.
I understand. I understand.
So well, if people think I'm out to make money, I don't even talk about it, actually.
Yeah, I can see that. I had to be pulled from you like a bad tooth. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello.
Good morning, David and Art.
Hi, where are you?
I'm from Dallas.
Dallas, Texas. Cliff Country, all right.
Yeah, I wanted to ask him about this article that I got some years ago from the Dallas Public Library here, and I heard about it over shortwave. It was two articles in June and July of, it was in Mechanics Illustrated of June and July 1957. I want to get this out there for other people to look up. The first article was kind of intriguing because it was written by a G. Harry Stein, who it says here was Chief Navy Range Operations at White Sands Proving Grounds.
That's right.
You've heard about this article?
I know of the man. I know of him.
Well, this article...
I was only 3 years old when that was written.
Hmm.
Well, y'all just got through talking about anti-gravity or magnetic drive a few minutes ago, and this article, I think, has great relevance to that. The title of it is Anti-Gravity, Power of the Future. And let me just read certain little quotes here. It talks about how recent discoveries that... indicated the spaceship of the future may be powered using anti-gravity. Mentioned a couple scientists, Sir William Crookes and Townsend T. Brown. And talked specifically about Townsend T. Brown and one of his experiments where he used two-disc airfoils. I'll just quote it here exactly. Rumors have been circulating that scientists have built disc airfoils two feet in diameter, incorporating a variation of the simple two-plate electrical condenser, which charged to a potential of 50,000 volts, has achieved a speed of 17 feet per second with a total energy output of 50 watts. A three-foot diameter disc airfoil charged to 150 kilovolts turned out such an amazing performance, the whole thing was immediately classified. And I kind of have to wonder if that's where things lie today.
And that's exactly the kind of description I've heard of these devices, capacitors, basically. Yes, David?
There's another guy that you need to check out. His name is Paul Hill. Heard of him? He wrote a book called Unconventional Flying Objects, UFO. Paul Hill was a scientist with NASA for years and years and years. Almost 30, I think 30 years. He was a doctor and physicist, and
when he passed on, his relatives...
His daughter found all his works in a roll-up desk.
God, I saw that on TV.
And produced it in the book, and I have it here in front of me. A friend of mine gave it to me. And I'll tell you what, this man, I can see why NASA's glad he had to die before he print this thing. Here's one of the chapters right here.
These were all privately kept notes.
Oh, it's very scientific. For instance, time requirements for interstellar travel, and he gives you all the mathematical formulas for it. And he was something. He shows, it's full of drawings, and here's him standing, a picture of him standing on a platform that's hovering.
Does his daughter do any interviews?
I don't think she does. I think she just produced this thing because she loved her father, and that was it, and she got it out. And it has been a heck of a seller, from what I understand. But I knew this guy when I was a child, and he this fantastic research scientist with NASA, and he was back here in the very beginning, in the middle 50s. But anyway, it's called Unconventional Flying Objects. You can buy it at bookstores, and the guy's name was Paul Heal. And it's probably the best, most respected scientific analysis of how a UFO could actually fly. And he gives you all the mathematics to show you how an electromagnetic engine could work.
Gotcha. All right. West of the Rockies, top of the morning, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell.
Good morning, Art. How are you doing?
Fine. Where are you?
I'm in San Diego.
San Diego. All right.
You're talking about the magnetic drives there. The Magnetic Pulse Propulsion Laboratory, which is headquartered here in San Diego, has had a contract with the DOD for doing work out at Area 51 for the last 12 years. They're classified work, but they have been doing work out there. But I was going to ask David, my father was one of the contributing editors for the Amazing Stories magazine,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the agent sitting in our living room questioning my dad about where he had gotten some of the information for the articles he'd written, but he was a member of the Pasadena Toastmasters Club, and Von Braun was a member, too.
Oh, yeah.
And they hit it off, and at least once a month, he was over our house having dinner. And I distinctly remember him being very vocal about the work that was going on at the facility in Nevada was wrong. Do you remember him being vocal about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, matter of fact, yes, he might have set me in the same path for the rest of my life, is that, the type of research work you do in there where it's okay to do research work within your own realm of science, but when you are privy to something from another planet, I mean, there's a moral issue here, and you just morally don't have the right to lock that up for any one country on the planet, and everyone in the entire world should be privy to it.
Since when, though, was national security concerned with morality?
I know.
Then or now?
Well, Von Braun was, though. He was a real...
Von Braun was an individual.
He was, and he had a lot of morals and ethics. That's why he had such a hard time doing work with the V2s, the way the Germans were using them. And
the collectivism of national security doesn't allow for morality. The individuals within that system, of course, have it.
Yeah, it's sad.
Sad but true. First time caller line, you're on the air with Art Bell and David Adair. Hello.
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 Hi, Art. This is Joe from San Francisco.
Hi, Joe.
And I have a question. First thing I want to say is that your program is the most outstanding program I've ever heard.
Thank you. It is different.
And I'm really, really into the UFO and the government problems and all that. I spent 20 years in the Navy. But anyway, I wanted to ask David, number one, how do you spell your last name?
Adair, A-D-A-I-R.
Oh, like the author. Okay. Next question was, you were talking about the engine and the vehicle and the people, saying that it was an ascension beings that were, that the whole thing was kind of a collective connected to together type thing?
Right.
And this was called what?
Symbiotic technology.
Symbiotic technology.
In other words, that the engine that he examined, the power plant that he examined, was symbiotically run just the way modern jets are beginning to be symbiotically run by their pilots. It might give you a little hint about where that technology began.
Imagine an engine that you could literally physically talk to, and it talks back to you.
Or think to.
Yeah, right. Actually, you think together.
Uh-huh.
That's symbiotic technology.
That's unreal.
It's yummy.
The thing that I wanted to ask, too, well, not ask you, but in the early 50s, I was really into this type of situation, too, and I had thought back then about the speed of light travel using electromagnetic field propulsion where you project it and then recapture it. Is that a feasible thing to look at, or am I way out in that field somewhere?
No, nobody's out of anything. I mean, somebody's theory that sounds strange to us, it could be the right one. One thing about theoretical physics, nobody's right or wrong, and you really can't prove somebody wrong, the more you can prove them right.
Well, I remember in high school, David. They would give us a test. They had a machine, and there would be a little red light that would come on, and you had your foot on an accelerator like you were in a car.
Uh-huh.
And when the little red light came on, you had to, as fast as you could, slam on the brake.
Okay.
And that tested your reaction time.
That's
now,
right.
A lot of things have to happen for your brain, for that red light to come on, your brain to process the information, your foot to begin to move from the
right.
accelerator to the brake. A lot of things have to happen before that brake is hit. And there's a little meter that would show what your reaction time was. Now, if instead of that lash up, you had something that was symbiotic, and all you had to do was think stop when the red light came on,
right.
it would be very difficult to measure the time interval before you hit the brake mentally.
It'd be instantaneous.
Exactly.
Like trying to beat a light bulb going off before you can get to the bed.
Exactly right. And so I can imagine at the speeds and the kind of maneuverability that such a craft would have, a symbiotic relationship would be absolutely necessary.
It would be.
Or we'd have Roswells all over the place.
Yeah.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling from South Carolina.
Yes, sir.
David, do you know Art's friend, Stan Deo?
No, I don't recognize the name.
Stan Deo lives in Australia. A very fine man, indeed. He's done a lot of work with naval satellite imagery. You probably don't know Stan. One of these days you ought to meet him. I can hook you up. Why do you ask, caller?
I believe I heard Stan say on your show one night that he had worked with anti-gravity, and that was how he got involved with the government.
He absolutely said that, yes.
That's interesting.
Oh, yes. You're not the only one out there, David. Stan Deo is indeed another. There are many.
Well, I'm sure. It would be a dangerous thing to get them all collected at one place.
Well, I think that was the dream of C. SETI, really.
Right.
And I wish that it would come true, and maybe if we just keep pushing. There's a fellow that I'm working with who is a Washington lobbyist who's trying to get things going in Washington and has worked with Dr. Greer. And they're making some very serious efforts now, so maybe. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello.
I was wondering if some of the thought control techniques like Major Ed Dames uses with remote viewing,
yeah,
if that type of thing could be used to, you know, give better control, like with these pilots that can't control their emotions or whatever, to give them better control.
Well, I would imagine that pilots, that's an interesting question. Where are you, caller?
San Antonio.
San Antonio, all right. I would imagine that pilots who are being introduced to the symbiotic method of control of modern high-performance jets are very carefully screened and trained. We kind of touched on that a little bit earlier. Now, whether it would move into a discipline that would include remote viewing, no, I doubt it, but some of the disciplines they might have to go through might be similar. Do you know much about that, David?
The only thing that I do know is required, even the pilots today, is that they have to learn to compartmentalize really well. In other words, everything that they ever think of is going on in life, they can put it in a compartment, close the door, and it never comes back up into their conscious thoughts.
Yeah.
So when they sit down in a craft, they are totally focused at all times on what they're doing, and they never let their mind stray, not even for a second. Mm-hmm. And, boy, that takes some discipline.
It certainly does. Okay, Wild Card Line, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hello.
Hi, my name is Gabriel in L.A.
Hi, Gabriel.
A couple quick questions. David, when you come out here to Hollywood, are you going to have any lectures out here?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yes, I do. I'm glad you asked that. I'll be doing a Whole Life Expo on November 22nd.
Okay.
I will be doing a lecture out there.
Where is that?
That will be in L.A. As a matter of fact,
L.A. is a big place. Do you have it?
Right here. Yeah, hold on. California Mart.
Uh-huh.
And I'll be talking at 11 o'clock, on Sunday, which is the 23rd.
Great.
And I'll be doing two programs on Sunday, one at 11 o'clock and one at 12 o'clock.
Okay. Another question. Nanotechnology. You talked about this engine sort of being alive and organic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our bodies are like, you know, made up of cells.
Right.
I was wondering if maybe this was some form of advanced nanotechnology.
All right. It's a good question. And
good question.
Yeah.
The material that it looked like it was made of, it was strange. Some parts of it was so rigid that, you know, I could stand on it. There was no give of any kind, like any alloyed steel. There were other parts that were interwoven with the hard parts that had a soft, pliable texture, very similar to like a, I don't know if you know how a dolphin feels, but it feels like a dolphin. It was real slick and smooth like
never,
that.
Never felt texture. A dolphin, but I can imagine that.
You can, you can look at their bodies, you know, it's kind of firm, but still soft. And but what was interesting is that the way they were coupled together, it would just, you couldn't hardly see a dividing line between it. Where you'd have a hard part and a soft part.
Well, wouldn't the merging of those kinds of materials require something at a nanotechnological level to achieve it?
I had no idea. I would assume it had to be some kind of technological process that we're not at any level at this point.
Well, nanotechnology is the promise of, ultimately, of microscopic or submicroscopic machines capable of creating and duplicating and replicating themselves until finally you end up with what is ordered. In other words,
A replicator from Star Trek.
Yes, sir.
The same thing.
Yep. Along those lines, yes.
Right, that I'd understand. But for this thing to have done what it, the way it looks, once again, it goes back to where it looks like alloys that grew. That's the only way I could describe it.
That grew. Well,
that
see,
grew.
That would make sense. And, of course, in our real world, the one we know for sure about, we are beginning to experiment now with nanotechnology, and maybe we're just starting down that road, or maybe we've been sent down that road.
I was going to say, wonder where they got the ideas, Art.
Yeah. Exactly. I think we've got time for one last. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Adair and Art Bell. Hi.
Hello.
Where are you?
I'm in Tennessee.
Tennessee, all right.
Yes, I'm concerned about the question of language with regarding the engine. Was there any written characters of any type on the engine, or you mentioned something about an exchange of information when you went into the craft. I know you don't want to talk about that.
All right. There, you know, Art, we did this last time, right at the very end. There was some kind of writings on the hull all over it in different places in clusters. And they weren't alphanumeric. They were more Sanskrit is the best way I can describe
Sanskrit.
It.
Sanskrit.
Like Arabic, the hieroglyphic. There was just symbols, just all these symbols strung into each other. But
just like Jesse Marcel talked about.
Right. And but I've seen those. The ones I saw were different.
Different.
But what was interesting, some of them would repeat themselves on the opposite side, but they'd be reversed. Just as if it was like left and right.
Huh.
So I thought that was interesting. And even one of the senators asked me about it and what I thought it was. And he was believing it was some kind of message or something. I said, no, I've seen these groupings of numbers before. And my gut feeling are, since I was a jet engine designer for 10 years, I think they're serial numbers. They were part numbers.
Serial numbers?
Yeah. In case you need to replace an entity, you have the inscripted code on it.
Boy, that makes all the sense in the world. We could do hours and hours and hours and hours. We actually have, but we could do many more, and we will. David Adair, what a pleasure to have had you on the program again.
All right,
and by the way, thank you for being here on my inaugural night with WABC in New York.
Well, it's my honor that you picked me. I'm amazed. So I appreciate that. I really do.
David, thank you and good night.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, folks, that's it. We are out of time. I must abide by the clock, and the clock says go away. So that's it. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Night all.